celebration and dish out some advice of their own.
The back of the plane is more enjoyable for an eating experience because there's more moisture in the air, because there's more bodies as opposed to first class. So I recommend going economy.
The Kitchen Cabinet with me, Jay Rayner, on Saturday mornings at 10:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
It's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 21st of August. Good morning. This is Today with Simon Jack and Michelle Hussein.
The headlines this morning: the Home Secretary has revealed more details about her plans to tackle illegal immigration, including an increase in return flights for failed asylum seekers. Barack and Michelle Obama have called on American voters to back a new chapter with Kamala Harris as president.
America's ready for a new chapter. America's ready for story. We are ready for a president, Kamala Harris.
We will go to the Democratic National Convention to hear from our very own Justin Webb.
Also on the programme this morning, what is the impact on the probation service of early prisoner release? We'll ask the Chief Inspector. We'll also return to the River Avon, where campaigners say water quality is some of the worst they've seen. And the cult video game series Civilization is coming back. The BBC News is read by Lisa Costello.
The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has announced new details of the government's plan for a border security command to tackle illegal immigration. 100 new intelligence and investigations officers will be appointed this year to target smuggling gangs. And the government is promising a large surge in returns flights for failed asylum seekers and others here illegally. The Conservatives said that by scrapping the plan to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda, Labour had shown they were not serious about stopping the boats. More from our political correspondent Harry Farley.
Labour have abandoned the Tory policy to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda. Instead, the government says these new specialist officers will increase the work the National Crime Agency is already doing to target gangs smuggling people across the channel. Yvette Cooper is also promising to reach the highest rate of removals since Theresa May's premiership. As part of that approach to forcibly remove more illegal migrants and failed asylum seekers, the Home Office has said it will continue with the previous government's plan to reopen two immigration centres near Oxford and Portsmouth.
Barack Obama has told the second day of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago that America is ready for a new chapter with Kamala Harris as president. Mr. Obama attacked the Republican candidate, Donald Trump, as weird and stale and said he hadn't stopped whining about his own grievances. The former president was introduced on stage by his wife, Michelle Obama, who told activists they were on the cusp of a brighter day.
The chance to vanquish the demons of fear, division, and hate that have consumed us and continue pursuing the unfinished promise of this great nation, the dream that our parents and grandparents fought and died and sacrificed for. America, hope is making a comeback.
The search operation for six people missing after a luxury yacht sank off the coast of Sicily has entered its third day. The Italian authorities have said divers are struggling to get into the wreck of the Baesian, which went down in a storm on Monday with 22 people on board. Among the missing is the British tech entrepreneur Mike Lynch. The body of the yacht's chef has been recovered. Our correspondent Mark Lowen reports from Sicily.
For a third straight day, the divers will be racing to reach the cabin of the Baesian superyacht, helped by remote-controlled vehicles that can operate on the seabed for far longer than the rescuers themselves. It is no longer survivors that they are trying to find, but bodies of the six missing passengers. British investigators are here in Sicily working to assess the disaster and whether measures were taken on board to mitigate the extreme weather, like closing hatches. All secrets that the Baesian may have taken down with it to the bottom of the ocean.
New data suggests the rising cost of renting has started to cool this year after a period of rapid increases. The figures shared with the BBC by the property portal Zoopla suggests rents for newly let homes are rising at their slowest rate for 3 years. But the data shows there are still 17 prospective tenants chasing each property on average. Imogen Pearson says finding somewhere to rent in Derby was tough.
We hadn't seen this house when we put a deposit down for the rent. I know. Which logically you should never do, but because we'd had a few where we were like wanted to see them first and then they just go. I was so scared that it was going to go.
Drones have been used successfully to deliver blood products between two hospitals in Northumberland. The trial by NHS Blood and Transplant and a medical logistics company examined how to reduce the carbon footprint of getting blood supplies around the country. A study suggests that eating just two slices of ham a day can raise the risk of developing type 2 diabetes in the next 10 years by 15%. The findings by scientists at the University of Cambridge have been published in the Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology Journal. Taylor Swift has wrapped up the European leg of her Eras tour with a record-breaking show at Wembley Stadium. The star played to more than 1.2 million fans in the UK this summer. Our music correspondent Mark Savage was at the final show.
Taylor Swift's tour has already broken box office records, but at her final UK show of the year, she told fans they'd helped her reach a new milestone.
You just made me the first solo artist to ever play Wembley 8 times in a single tour.
She marked the occasion by playing the song So Long London live for the first time. The star now takes a two-month break before the final leg of the Eras tour resumes in North America. So long,
Mark Savage reporting.
Thank you, Lisa. 6 minutes past six. Let's get our first look at the weather. Thomas Schaffernacker is in the BBC Weather Centre. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning to you, Simon. Fairly quiet on the weather front across most of the UK this morning. Just a few fleeting showers across western parts of the UK. But if you are heading out already early in the morning, it's looking dry and clear across most parts. Now, the weather will turn a little bit later on, particularly in the northwest of the UK. In fact, from northern England through much of Scotland and also Northern Ireland, we're expecting thicker cloud later this morning, and eventually rain will sweep in off the Atlantic on an increasingly strong southwesterly wind. And in fact, around the north coast of Northern Ireland, western Scotland, we can expect winds up to gale force, but further inland, not quite so windy. Later in the afternoon, there will be some rain across the lowlands and it should reach Belfast too. Now, the temperatures in the north as a result will be lowest, around 15 degrees. Now, the rest of England, so central and southern areas, as well as Wales, will have plenty of dry and bright weather through the morning and into the afternoon. But I think later in the day, it will also cloud over. There might be some rain in the north of Wales, possibly across the Peak District, but the further south and east you are, the drier and brighter the weather will be today. So in central parts of England, perhaps 18 degrees, but in the sunny spells across East Anglia and the southeast, we can expect temperatures up to 23. And then tonight into tomorrow, wet and windy weather sweeping across the UK yet again. Back to you.
Thomas, thank you very much. 8 minutes past six now. Let's have a look at the papers. Many of the front pages reflecting the ongoing search operation in Sicily for a second day. Probe into hatches left open on doomed super yacht is the Daily Telegraph's headline. It focuses on comments made by one expert who said the investigation would look at whether the crew failed to close hatches, allowing the yacht to fill up with water quickly and sink. The Daily Express has a still of CCTV footage captured from a nearby villa showing the moments before the yacht capsized.
The Guardian says the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is planning to raise taxes, cut spending and get tough on benefits in the budget in October. A Treasury source has told the paper that despite improved economic growth in the first half of this year, nothing in the recent data can offset the scale of the black hole in the public finances.
Some of the papers also feature photographs of the King on his visit to Southport yesterday, surrounded by flowers left for the victims of last month's deadly knife attack. The Sun reports he will host the families of the three girls who died at a reception in London today. The Daily Mail says that following the event at Buckingham Palace, the King is due to return to Balmoral.
The Times is one of the papers highlighting a study by the University of Cambridge, which suggests that eating just two slices of ham a day could increase a person's risk of developing diabetes within 10 years by 15%.
15%. The research, published in the Lancet Medical Journal, indicates that eating 100 grams of unprocessed red meat a day, equivalent to a small steak, also carries a higher risk.
The Daily Star features an account by the veteran actor Sir Ian McKellen, who says he's nervous to leave his home after his recent fall during a West End show. Sir Ian was speaking in an interview with Saga magazine, and he said he suffered agonising pain, adding he was lucky that a fat suit he was wearing in his role as Falstaff saved his ribs.
There is scorn in the USA, according to the Daily Mirror, which reveals that Nigel Farage is to be the keynote speaker at a US summit, his second trip stateside in just over a month. It says the Reform UK leader and MP for Clacton will attend the event in the state of Arizona this Saturday, much to the unhappiness of some of his constituents who have spoken to the paper. Mr. Farage said the engagement was organised well before July's election.
The time is now 6:10.
Former President Barack Obama has been taking the stage at the Democrat National Convention, at which Kamala Harris has been chosen as the Democratic candidate to take on Donald Trump in November's election, replacing Joe Biden, of course. Obama, of course, appointed Joe Biden as his vice president. He was critical of Donald Trump throughout his speech.
We do not need four more years of bluster and bumbling and chaos. We have seen that movie before, and we all know that the sequel is usually worse.
Well, Emma Vardy is our US correspondent, is there. Emma, who's the audience for this, for Barack Obama today?
Well, inside the arena, of course, it's a very friendly audience. It's hundreds of Democratic delegates. But this event really is made for TV. And what really matters, of course, is the audience outside this arena, and particularly those voters watching in swing states, because they will play an outsized role in deciding the result of this election. But of course, the Obamas taking to the stage tonight, they are both still two very popular figures for the Democratic Party. No Democratic presidential candidate has been as successful as Barack Obama has since his winning campaign of 2008. And he brought back some of those past themes of his campaign to try and evoke some of the same messages of hope and optimism from back then. And Democrats are hoping that Kamala Harris can now attract the same coalition of voters that led to Barack Obama's big win in 2008.
He was critical of Donald Trump, was it? But it was done with sort of humour. They didn't dwell too much on Donald Trump.
No, often, you know, both him and Michelle Obama didn't reference him by name, but of course it was blatantly obvious who they were talking about. Barack Obama painted Donald Trump as a man of the past, you know, comparing him to a bad movie sequel. You know, he called him stale. Those things went down very, very well in this arena. And, you know, I think tonight the Obamas just really lent their firepower and their star appeal to Kamala Harris to help her try to achieve her aim. She's yet to appear, of course. She's coming on stage on Thursday. She's going to make her speech then. But beyond
and
here...
And what does she need to do when she does take the stage? Is it, she need to introduce herself to a US population who probably don't know her that well?
You're right. The reason is this has all happened so quickly. She only became the Democratic candidate over the past month since Joe Biden pulled out. Most presidential nominees by this point have had months of campaigning and months of rallies to lay out to the voters exactly who they are and what they stand for. And there is this feeling now that Kamala Harris needs to put more detailed policies out there. There's been somewhat of a scramble behind the scenes to do that. But this is now seen as her opportunity to tell people more about what she stands for, what a presidency under her would look like.
OK. Emma Vardy, thank you very much for that. And we'll get the thoughts of our own Justin Webb a little bit later in the programme.
Well, the US Secretary of State is meanwhile on his way home from the Middle East. He has told the BBC that Israel has agreed to a schedule and locations for withdrawing its troops from Gaza. John Donison is our correspondent in Jerusalem. But in the face of that, what are the signals from the Israeli government, John?
Well, I think there's probably quite a lot of frustration from the Americans. This issue of the extent to which Israel is going to withdraw its forces from Gaza as part of this deal, and in particular along the border with Egypt, is a key sticking point. And I think there is a feeling that Mr. Blinken is having to tread a pretty fine line to keep both sides happy. There's probably going to be some very nuanced language in this bridging proposal to try and keep those sides happy. But Mr. Netanyahu seems to be saying one thing to the Americans and other things to the audience here in Israel. He spoke to two groups of families of hostages yesterday and reportedly told them that he had convinced Mr. Blinken that Israeli troops should remain in key parts of Gaza, including along the border with Egypt. And the reaction from the US, a senior State Department official, said maximalist statements like this are not constructive to getting a ceasefire deal across the line. And of course, Mr. Blinken has now left the region on his ninth visit since October the 7th.
What are the indications, meanwhile, from Hamas?
Well, Hamas at the moment are basically saying that they signed up to a deal back in July that has now been changed. And at this point, they're saying any idea that progress has been made is an illusion. Those ceasefire talks are due to resume in Egypt again tomorrow and the following day. But at the moment, Hamas are not taking part. So it's very, very difficult to see that any sort of breakthrough is imminent.
John Donison, thank you.
It is 6:15 exactly. The rate at which people's rent is rising is showing some signs of starting to ease off. That's according to data shared with the BBC. Will Bain has more on that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Will.
Morning, Simon. Morning, Michelle. Yeah, this is analysis from the property website Zoopla that they shared with us here at the BBC. And it shows that while rents are still going up, the cost of a new tenancy is increasing at its slowest rate since October 2021. Charlie Bryant is Zoopla's chief executive. Morning.
Good morning, Will.
Talk us through the other sort of top-line findings.
Yes, as you say, I think the primary thing, the good news, is that for the first time in quite a while, rents are rising at a rate equivalent to earnings. We've seen a long period where rental rates have accelerated ahead of earnings, tightening affordability in that rental market. It's still not easy. There are still 17 people chasing every rental property that's out there, but that is down from over 30 in recent times. And so we're beginning to see a bit more steadiness, a bit more supply-demand balance coming into the rental market.
Just to be clear as well, these figures are for people seeking new tenancies, right? These are not people perhaps who want to stay where they are.
Yes, that's correct. Although undoubtedly there will be cases where landlords will look to change the rent at a tenancy renewal, but these are generally for people who are out there trying to find their next home to rent.
Well, I was going to say, surely they're the ones who are perhaps being squeezed even more, right? If they don't want to move, can't move, you know, don't want to shake up where their commute is going from, potentially they could be skewing this data a little bit more as well.
They could be, yes.
What do you think is driving down? What is it causing? Well, perhaps driving down is the wrong phrase, but causing this easing, taking some of the heat out, perhaps?
I think it's really just more properties coming to market. So the average estate agent at the moment has about 17% more homes to rent than a year ago. They still have about a third less homes to rent than they had in the pre-pandemic average. But it's just really about more properties coming into the market. And
why is that? What's sort of moving that seesaw?
A lot of people are coming back into the purchase market. So we've seen mortgage rates come off a little bit. We expect about 10% more homes to be sold this year. A lot of people who are renting are obviously still looking to purchase, and that's become more affordable and really more predictable as mortgage rates have now steadied around the sort of plus or minus 4% level.
Do you have a sense, do you have a view on what would kind of aid that kind of increase in getting more properties to be available for people to rent?
I think it's two things. I mean, number one, we're certainly seeing a shift in the UK from the traditional mom-and-pop landlord. The UK has historically been a market where the majority of homes to rent are owned by private individuals who may have become a landlord by accident. They may be a couple who've decided to move in together and therefore one of them's decided to rent out their other home. We're seeing that become more corporatized now. So about 20% of the 5.5 million rented homes in the UK are actually owned by corporates. We're seeing obviously a big drive from the current government around new homes being built. Some of those will fall into the build to rent market, which today is only about 5% of our total rental stock. And that's significantly lower than other areas in Europe.
Right. So encouraging that. I mean, when you're talking about these corporates stepping in instead of mums and dads renting these houses out, I mean, do you see that as a good thing for the market?
I think it is. It brings a, if you like, an institutionalization of the market, greater predictability, greater professionalism, greater homogeneity of stock. You know, there are people there who will who are doing this rental as a business, and so I think over the long term, it is a good thing.
The interesting thing that a lot of your data is able to do is really zoom in geographically as well. What are you seeing in terms of trends and other particular pressure points within the country? Presumably, ones that might be obvious, but are there ones that are less obvious?
Yes, I think the reality is that, you know, the property market's inevitably always a regional story. What we are seeing with rents is, whilst nationally the good news is, as I said, that rents are coming down below, or rental increases are coming down below the rate of earnings increases, there are inevitably hotspots. These tend to be the more better value areas that are located close to large cities and are therefore still attractive for commuters. So in areas like Rochdale, Doncaster, you know, Southend, Sunderland, those types of areas, you're still seeing higher rental increase because they have been traditionally better value than, let's say, London and the South East.
And can I just get a quick take from you on front page of the Financial Times and others have got this morning. Rachel Reeves plans above inflation rise in social rents to boost house building. This plan, what do you make of it?
We need to ensure that obviously the house built, the homes that are built by the house builders have a variety of tenures in them. And so they need to be those that are going to go to owner occupiers, those that are going to go to professional landlords, those that are going to go to social rents. And it's really important that affordability works across all those tenures. So ensuring that those who are in receipt of housing benefit receive enough to actually rent a home is something we've been campaigning about for a long time. So welcome that.
And in short, on the overall headline on this rent picture, do you see this as a trend, or is this a blip? Is the trend going to be that we are going to continue to see this easing?
Over the long term, housing market has to be driven by affordability. So I hope this is a sign that actually the very high rental increases that we've seen in recent years are falling away to something that is more affordable and more in line with earnings increase. That's important for the health of the market.
Charlie, thanks so much for your time this morning. That's Charlie Bryant there, the chief executive of the property website Zoopla. We're listening to that is George Godber, fund manager at Polar Capital. George, morning.
Good morning, Will.
I guess an important part of, we had the inflation data, didn't we, from the ONS last week, important in how, you know, rents and mortgages, of course, as well, factor into that wage conundrum too. People needing higher wages, demanding, asking their employer for higher wages because their rents and their mortgages have been going up.
Absolutely. I mean, housing costs fall into some bits of UK inflation statistics and not others. But let's cut to the chase. You know, if the pressure for workers and, you know, what, you know, when they are demanding pay rises, if their biggest single item is housing, be it mortgages or rental costs, has been shooting up, then of course they're going to be, you know, asking for higher wages to cover those basic necessities. And that's why the Bank of England's focused so much on it in terms of, you know, the pressure that's been putting on the economy. So it's great to see it easing, and it is consistent with this narrative of a generally easing inflationary picture within the UK economy.
Perhaps where the pressure still looks to be on somewhat was these stats that we had out from the insolvency service yesterday, saying the number of companies in England, Wales, that became insolvent in the last month was 16% higher than the same period last year. What are some of those pressures still, do you think, from looking at the numbers?
So, especially for smaller businesses, they've got two great pressures. One is, how do you deal with the higher borrowing costs, as we've seen rates rise? And how do you deal with those higher labour costs, and how do you pass that? Are you even able to pass that through to your customers? I think if we were to then maybe focus on a little bit of a good news or hope story, as rates come down, then of course that will alleviate some of those very, you know, strong pressures that companies have been feeling.
Yeah, and we're going to be hearing a lot more about interest rates, probably starting from tomorrow, right, with this meeting of Federal Reserve Bank governors in Jackson Hole. How much interest is the market paying to that?
It always gets a lot of interest because I think it appears at a time in the news cycle when things are quiet.
And it's in a pretty place and it looks good on the TV.
Exactly. And maybe as I look out already, thinking about the autumnal weather outside the UK, in the UK, you're thinking, yeah, it would be nice to be elsewhere. However, I think we should be looking for key indications about whether the Federal Reserve will be looking to cut in September, because I think they will want to cut early so that they're not seen to be interfering with the US election in November.
Yeah, well, all of this is factoring into the currency markets, of course, and George is going to stay with us, but we want to bring Jane Foley, Head of Foreign Exchange Strategy at Rabobank, into the conversation. Morning, Jane. Oh, have we got Jane's line there?
Good morning, Will.
What's your sense about why the pound was on the move this week?
Well, the pound yesterday reached its highest level for just over a year. But this, of course, is much more related to what's going on in the dollar. And in fact, the events that you've just been talking about, the Jackson Hole event, the symposium for the central bankers out there in Kansas. And the market is expecting, as we've just heard, that the Federal Reserve will be cutting interest rates in September. Now, it's our view that they will go by 25 basis points, a quarter of 1%. But there's been a lot of excitement in the market that they may have to cut interest rates by more. In fact, there's been a lot of excitement on and off, particularly over the last month, that maybe the US economy is slowing a lot quicker than the market had been anticipating. And today we get some revisions for the US labor market. And maybe that will show that job growth in the US over the last year has actually been a lot weaker than the official data have been reported. And that is what the market has been focusing on this week. And I think perhaps getting a little bit ahead of themselves in pricing in Fed interest rate cuts.
Right. So just explain that all the way through and why that then has the impact it does on the dollar.
Well, it's quite simple. The very basics of foreign exchange is related to interest rates. And it's exactly the same story, is that if you had some savings and you walked down the high street to look for a savings account, you would go for the savings account with a higher interest rate. So when central banks start to lower their interest rates, money tends to flow out of that currency and into another currency.
So potentially, George, more of a sort of worse news story for the dollar than a good news story for the pound. But what has it meant in terms of UK companies, listed companies?
Well, actually, part of the attraction for sterling has been, we're seen as being politically stable. We've got a volatile election coming up in America, and Europe is struggling. You know, big problems politically in Germany. And so actually, sterling's been seen, again, hopefully, fingers crossed, as a bit of a safe haven. And so that's helping. That's probably, you know, beneficial for sort of UK shares here, especially UK domestic shares.
And Jane, is that the outlook? I mean, you look at the data going, looking a lot further ahead.
Well, you know, what I would say about sterling is, yes, it is the best performing G10 currency in the year to date. And yes, it was the second best performing G10 currency last year, too. But the level's about 130, although they're, you know, and this is against the US dollar, although they appear to be, you know, relatively strong compared with where we have been in the last few years for sterling, that doesn't make it a strong currency. The average level for cable, which is sterling against US dollar in the last few decades, is about 150, just above 150. And so we've got to remember that in the tail end of 2022, which of course was the Liz Truss era, sterling against the US dollar hit its lowest level ever. And what we've been seeing since is a more stable political environment helping to allow sterling to recover.
Interesting one to keep watching. Jane, thank you very much for your time. Jane Foley there, Head of FX Strategy at Rabobank, and George Godber, the fund manager at Polar Capital.
Will, thank you. 27 minutes past six. The sport this morning is with Mike Williams. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Michelle. Good morning. England's men will continue a truncated summer of Test cricket later today when their three-match series with Sri Lanka gets underway at Old Trafford. Ollie Pope will become England's 82nd Test captain as he deputises for the injured Ben Stokes. Bowler Matthew Potts will make his debut with Dan Lawrence opening the batting in place of the injured Zach Crawley. Correspondent Jonathan Agnew looks ahead.
After the overall disappointment in the quality of the series against West Indies, there's a widespread hope that Sri Lanka will provide a stiffer challenge as England continue to build for the future. That has, of course, been severely disrupted by the injury to Stokes. Pope will lead the team, having only been captain in one first-class match, but now has three games in which to gain valuable experience. Lawrence, usually a mid-order batsman, is rewarded for his patience on the fringes and will open with Duckett. And Potts returns as one of five bowlers who will challenge Sri Lanka's experienced batting lineup, which, like West Indies and visiting test teams in general, is a long way short of adequate preparation.
And we will look ahead to day one of the first test a little later in the programme with Sir Alistair Cook. Next, to tennis and the ongoing fallout to the news announced yesterday that world number one Jannik Sinner will not face any ban from playing despite twice testing positive for the banned anabolic agent Clostobol in March of this year. A provisional suspension was applied automatically, but as Sinner challenged that successfully, he was able to keep playing and has now been cleared outright of any wrongdoing. The International Tennis Integrity Agency found Sinner was inadvertently contaminated with the substance by his physiotherapist. More from our tennis correspondent Russell Fuller.
Sinner's legal team themselves have said that less than a billionth of a gram was involved, and it got into Sinner's system because the physio was treating him without gloves, and there are questions to be asked there as well. Mm-hmm. But he has, despite having had a stressful few months, got away with purely the loss of the ranking points and the prize money, $325,000, that he earned at the tournament in question at Indian Wells in March. So he remains as the world number one. He can play in the US Open next week.
Yes, the US Open starting on Monday. Former Wimbledon finalist Nick Kyrgios, though, has strongly criticised the ruling on Sinner, calling it ridiculous. In football, the Manchester City midfielder Phil Foden has been named as the PFA's Player of the Year, with his England teammate Cole Palmer of Chelsea winning the Young Player Award. Khadija Shaw, also of Manchester City, won the Women's Award, with Manchester United's Grace Clinton taking the Young Player Award. Finally, the tips are back for the start of York's Ebor Festival this afternoon. The first at 2:25. Our selection is number 11, Yarug, and then at 3:35, again, number 11, Calandagran.
Thanks very much, Mike.
Storyteller.
I think what drives me on has always been curiosity.
Activist.
Definitely was a builder of the bridge between music and charity.
Superstar.
17 Grammy Awards, 4 Brit Awards, 2 Ivor Novello Awards.
This is the story of Sting.
Eras. Sting.
How a boy done good, from the terraces of Wall's End to sold-out stadiums across the world. Join me, Vernon Kay, as I get into the career of one of Britain's best-selling artists.
I knew I could sing, I knew I could play, I just needed to get lucky.
Listen now on BBC Sounds. Just search Eras Sting.
The time is just after 6:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Simon Jack, Michelle Hussein and Lisa Costello.
The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has given more details of plans for a border security command to tackle illegal immigration. 100 new intelligence and investigations officers will be brought into the National Crime Agency this year to target smuggling gangs. The government says there'll also be a surge in return flights for migrants here illegally. Barack and Michelle Obama have delivered passionate endorsements of Kamala Harris on the second day of the US Democratic Party convention, saying America was ready for a new chapter with her as president. The former first lady said hope was making a comeback. Mr. Obama also attacked the Republican candidate Donald Trump as weird, selfish and dangerous. The search operation is entering a third day for the 6 people who are missing after a boat sank off the coast of Sicily on Monday. The British tech entrepreneur Mike Lynch and the Morgan Stanley International Bank chairman Jonathan Bloomer are among those unaccounted for. The body of the yacht's chef has been recovered. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said a proposal for a Gaza ceasefire deal involves a detailed plan for Israeli troop withdrawals from the territory. He was responding to reported comments by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, suggesting he had persuaded Mr. Blinken that Israeli forces must stay in strategic parts of Gaza. New data suggests the rising cost of renting has started to cool this year after a period of rapid increases. The figures shared with the BBC by the property portal Zoopla suggests rents for newly let homes are rising at their slowest rate for 3 years. But the data shows there are still 17 prospective tenants chasing each property on average. A study suggests that eating just 2 slices of ham a day can raise the risk of developing type 2 diabetes in the next 10 years by 15%. Scientists at the University of Cambridge also found a heightened risk from as little as 100 grams of unprocessed red meat a day, equivalent to a small steak. The findings have been published in the Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology Journal.
Lisa, thank you very much. The government is announcing details of its new border security command today, aimed at stopping small boats across the channel. It involves more investigating officers and more people being deported. First, though, let us talk about small boat numbers with Simon Jones, our correspondent in Dover. What is the current picture on arrival, Simon?
Well, when Yvette Cooper became Home Secretary at the start of last month, she warned it was going to be a difficult summer. And I think it's certainly proving to be that way in terms of small boat crossings. In many ways, it's been business as usual in the Channel. And since Labour came to power, 5,720 migrants have crossed the Channel on small boats. You can stand on those famous white cliffs of Dover and see the Border Force and RNLI bringing groups of people on busy days. And there was a very busy day earlier this month, 703 people arriving in one day. And earlier this week, we had a day when there were 69 people per boat. It gives you an idea that although we talk about small boats, these boats have been getting bigger and bigger with more and more people packed onto them. To be fair, figures do tend to increase in the summer with the better weather. The sea is calm and the numbers this summer are actually down slightly on the numbers we saw last summer. I think what's interesting though is we're not hearing the government now talking about stopping the boats, but they're talking rather about ending the chaos and having a better controlled system. And I think they're warning that numbers making the crossing over the Channel are likely to increase before the situation improves.
But what do we know about those who are arriving and how many are from countries to which they could be deported if they're not eligible for asylum?
Well, I think that's the big problem, because there has been a big increase in the number of people arriving from Vietnam, and people arriving from Vietnam are considered to be particularly at risk of being exploited, either working in the grey economy in cannabis factories or even in the sex industry. There has been a returns agreement with Vietnam, so the government believes it can remove people to Vietnam, but then you've still got a lot of people arriving from countries like Afghanistan, where there is no returns agreement. It's not considered safe to return people to. And I think that is the big issue, because it's all very well talking about returning people, but you've got to have somewhere to return them to. And that's why the previous government had the idea of sending people to Rwanda to act as a deterrent. Labour, of course, scrapped that as soon as they came to power. But it is leaving opposition politicians saying it's all very well saying you're going to increase returns, but where exactly are you going to send people to?
Simon, thank you very much. On that note, let's turn to Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent. And we don't have a minister offered for interview on the airwaves this morning, Henry, to talk through these plans. Is there a qualitative difference in what Labour are promising compared to what was there under the Conservatives? I mean, setting the Rwanda plan aside, these pledges on more border officials and on more return flights.
Well, they are new technocratic, if you will, policies. Couple of new measures being announced by Yvette Cooper, the Home Secretary, today. So one of them is to send 100 new intelligence and investigation officers to the National Crime Agency to help target smuggling gangs. The other one is reopening two old immigration detention centres, one near Oxford, one in Hampshire, which means that capacity at those removal centres will rise by 290 places. I mean, those are actually both measures that are being welcomed by the Conservatives today. There's also a target that is new. They are saying that they want, over the next 6 months, returns of failed asylum seekers to increase to levels last seen in 2018. That probably amounts, though Labour aren't using, or the government isn't using this number, to a target to remove about 14,400 people in the second half of this year. But in terms of a qualitative difference, I guess it really is moving from that eye-catching Rwanda policy, which the last government spent a lot of energy on but never managed to get off the ground, a lot of money on as well, to these sorts of small technocratic fixes, which I think the new government hopes will add up over time to a much more efficient removals policy.
But there isn't a concrete target that they could be held to.
Well, there is this pledge from Yvette Cooper this morning to have the numbers of removals over the second half of the year at the highest rate since 2018, when Theresa May was Prime Minister and Amber Rudd was Home Secretary some time ago, many Home Secretaries ago, many Prime Ministers ago. But that's not sort of at the heart, at the centrepiece of what the government is saying. We're not sort of in, as Simon was saying there, we're not sort of in the rhetoric of stop the boats anymore. But, you know, ultimately, this government knows that a plank of its electoral coalition was won from parts of the country where perhaps previous Conservative voters were fed up with what they perceived as that previous government's failure to address this issue. And they know that they will be judged, at least by some of their new electoral coalition, on their ability to address it.
Henry Zaffman, thank you.
The search is continuing for the six people missing after a superyacht sank off the coast of Sicily, having been hit by a tornado-like waterspout. The missing include the UK entrepreneur Mike Lynch, who was on a cruise with his lawyer, business associates and friends to celebrate his acquittal of fraud charges after 13 years of litigation. Bethany Bell is in Sicily. Bethany, are we looking at a rescue mission now, or this recovery? There's some suggesting that there's a slim possibility that there's an air pocket inside. What's the mood of those engaged in the hunt?
The rescuers know that with every passing hour, the chances of finding people still alive and the hopes of finding still people alive is fading. They are racing to try to reach the cabin of the super yacht. We understand the divers themselves have about a minute to go down to the deep waters where the yacht is. They spend 10 minutes trying to access the yacht, and then they have to come back up again. But they're also working with remote controlled vehicles, which can operate on that seabed for much longer than the divers can. They are really having enormous difficulties, they say, to access the wreck itself. Meanwhile, we've also been hearing from the emergency services who've been helping those who did survive. One doctor said that the word everyone kept using was darkness, the darkness that they experienced when the waves hit the boat and the boat was lifted up and then sank.
Yeah, and the focus is now turning, certainly you look at the newspapers here today, on how a boat of that size could have sunk so quickly. And some of the attention turned to whether the hatches were opened, whether appropriate safety procedures were followed.
Yes, and there is a team of British investigators here in Sicily working to try and assess the disaster to see whether all measures that were taken that might have been able to mitigate the extreme weather, including closing the hatches. But this is all a question at the moment. It's very, very difficult to reach the yacht. First of all, they have to account for the missing people before they can then figure out exactly how this happened.
Indeed. OK, Bethany Bell, thank you.
20 to 7. Let's have a look at the papers and the Guardian's lead story this morning. While the yacht is mentioned on the front page, the main story is ahead of the latest official set of borrowing figures due out today. The paper says Rachel Rees is planning to raise taxes, cut spending and get tough on benefits in October's budget amid Treasury alarm that the pickup in the economy has failed to improve the poor state of the public finances. She's accused the Conservatives already of covering up the true state of the public finances. That's when she announced an initial £5.5 billion of savings. The subsequent release of figures showing the UK economy grew by 0.6% between April and June led to speculation, the Guardian says, there might be a knock-on effect on the public finances that might allow Reeves to limit the pain in her October budget. But a source has told the Guardian, we don't accept the positive economic inheritance line given the decade that went before. Nothing in the recent data can offset the scale of the black hole in the public finances that we're looking at.
The sinking of the yacht does make the front pages of a number of newspapers. Sunk in 60 seconds is the headline in The Sun. The yacht plunged in storm. They're saying the rescuers now are trying to breach the hull. Robert Hardman, writing for the Mail, the headline is, could anyone still be alive? Saying there's the slimmest of hopes that, but given the angle at which the boat is underneath on its side, there could be some air pockets in there, but hope is fading fast. The Daily Express has a picture which appears a rather grainy picture of the mast of the boat being consumed by those heavy winds and rain. And the Daily Telegraph says probe into hatches left open on doomed super yacht. It's been suggested the missing passengers could still be alive, but their focus now is on whether those hatches could have been open, which would explain how so much water got into a boat so quickly and sank it so fast.
The main story for The Eye comes after officials in Brussels have said that the new European Travel Information and Authorisation System, this is a visa waiver system, it is on course to launch in the spring. And the paper is warning Brits without new 7 euro EU visa face being turned away at airports in 2025. There'll be no special treatment for the UK on looming travel rules despite Labour's Brexit reset. Talks lobbying by the Conservatives and by the present government has failed to win a relaxation of new EU red tape, it says, which means British travellers won't be able to board plane, train or ferries to 30 countries in the European Union unless they have one of these valid ETIAS visa waivers from the spring of next year.
And the Times has a warning to the Prime Minister that empowering unions will stifle growth. They're saying business chiefs are increasingly worried that early recognition of unions and extra workers' rights will begin, could deter employers from taking on new people and thereby stifle growth.
Our main news this morning, the Home Secretary is giving new details of the government's plan to tackle illegal immigration, including the recruitment of 100 investigators to target smuggling gangs.
President Barack Obama and his wife Michelle made their case for Kamala Harris's presidency at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago with back-to-back speeches. Our correspondent Emma Vardy was there and can tell us how the night unfolded.
Chicago, you ready?
There was a DJ on the decks, a rapper on the mic, and a party atmosphere in the arena. People danced as state by state, delegates cast their votes, choosing Kamala Harris as the Democrats' presidential nominee. But this was only symbolic. The official process had happened 2 weeks earlier to meet ballot deadlines. But states delivered their endorsements with enthusiasm.
Illinois casts 176 votes for the next president of the United States.
The delegates at the Democratic National Convention, well, they just completed their roll call.
Kamala Harris joined live over video from her rally in the swing state of Wisconsin.
And they have nominated Coach Walls and me to be the next vice president and president of the United States of America.
We are ready for a president, Kamala Harris.
There was always going to be huge importance placed on the words of former President Barack Obama. And first, he paid tribute to Joe Biden.
History will remember Joe Biden as an outstanding president who defended democracy at a moment of great danger.
And he delivered a scathing characterization of Donald Trump, portraying him as a man of the past.
It is one of the oldest tricks in politics from a guy whose act has, let's face it, gotten pretty stale. We do not need four more years of bluster and bumbling and chaos. We have seen that movie before, and we all know that the sequel is usually worse.
And one of the most popular figures in U.S. politics, Michelle Obama, received a standing ovation.
Hope is making a comeback.
The former First Lady, who famously said she doesn't like politics, had this political crowd electrified. And she went after Donald Trump for his recent comment, which backfired over black jobs.
See, his limited, narrow view of the world made him feel threatened by the existence of two hardworking, highly educated, successful people who happen to be black. I want to know. Who's going to tell him that the job he's currently seeking might just be one of those black jobs?
There was a personal touch as Kamala Harris's family took to the stage. Her husband Doug revealing that she delights in replaying his awkward first date voicemail back to him every anniversary.
I got Kamala's voicemail and I just started rambling. Hey, it's Doug.
From the sea to the river.
Outside, pro-Palestinian protesters clashed with police in a second night of large demonstrations which are set to continue. But in this arena, tonight will be remembered as the moment that the Obamas lent their star appeal, born out of victories past, to Kamala Harris in a bid to persuade voters to choose her as the future.
That's Emma Vardy reporting on the Democratic National Convention. The time is 13 minutes to 7. There is considerable interest in the possible use of drones for deliveries in the UK. There are quite a few projects that are now subject to trials overseen by the Civil Aviation Authority, but there have been questions about whether it would be safe to send items such as blood products this way. Now, however, there's been a comparison study of blood samples that were transported by road and by drone. Rebecca Cardigan is from NHS Blood and Transplant. What did you find, Rebecca?
Well, we found that when we transported blood by drone, there was really very little impact on the blood compared to transporting it by ground. So we were really delighted with the outcome of these first steps in our studies to assess this.
That essentially the sample wasn't damaged in any way.
That's absolutely right, indicating that from a patient point of view, it would be completely safe to transport blood in this manner.
What was the worry, that it wouldn't be kept in a refrigerator or something to do with the motion in the air?
It's both of those things. So obviously when you fly with drones or indeed anything, there's the risk of vibration and acceleration, which can affect blood and potentially cause it to lyse. But also when we're transporting blood and particularly red blood cells, they need to be kept at refrigerated temperatures. So we need to ensure that that is maintained throughout the entire journey.
So what was the alternative to refrigeration for the sample that went by drone?
So if we're transporting blood, clearly we can't put it in a fridge. So what we do is we use specially designed transport boxes that contain a special insulated material to keep your blood at exactly the right temperature for that duration.
And what was the duration? What kind of distance was part of this trial?
In this case, this is the longest time that we have transported blood by this method, and it was around an hour as a test flight.
Mm. And just to explain the study, you did choose the same journey essentially, and there was there were drones that were set off, and then there were blood samples that went by road as well.
That's correct. So it was a sort of what we would call a randomised trial using the identical material in both forms of transport. One went in our usual ground transportation and the other went by drone. There were slightly different routes due to having to, you know, comply with the Civil Aviation Authority, but they were the same distance and duration effectively.
There wasn't much difference in the time, though. The drone was only marginally quicker.
That's right, but that's because the drone had to take a non-direct route for the reasons that I've just described. So in a real-world situation, particularly where we're looking at transportation within urban areas and so on, we would predict that the drone flight may be quicker.
Okay. But
and
would
that's
it really
what we will
be,
assess in further studies.
Would it really be much quicker than by motorbike, for example?
I think it depends on the scenario. So we're particularly interested in urban areas where getting to the scene of an accident where it may be difficult, but also in situations like in the military where ground transportation is obviously extremely challenging in the battlefield. So there are scenarios where we think this could be potentially quicker, but also we're very interested as well in the effect on our sort of environmental footprint, because we currently have a very large ground transportation network with nearly 300 hospitals in the UK.
So is this enough for you to start using this then, this system?
Not currently. This is the first step in a series of studies where we're going to assess its suitability, both for the safety of carrying blood, but also some of the, you know, logistical challenges regarding the sort of regulatory framework and the with the Civil Aviation Authority, etc. And we obviously need to do a sort of economic analysis of it in order to be able to implement. But we're absolutely delighted that this first step is really positive, and we're looking forward to those further studies.
Rebecca Cardigan from NHS Blood and Transplant, thank you.
It is 8 minutes to seven. The UK's network of canals risks falling into serious disrepair without more investment, according to the Canal and River Trust. The charity is warning that some canals may have to be shut if a real terms funding cut announced by the last government is not reversed. At their best, canals are a pleasant focal point for the communities through which they run, but they are often not like that. Jane Priest lives in Kidderminster and volunteers as a litter picker along the canals.
I'm heading down now towards Fallen Sands Viaduct, where Seven Valley Railway cross the canal. It's an area where there's a roadway down to the towpath, and where very often we find things that have been just fly-tipped by vans, by cars. As I'm walking along now, I can see there's litter. There's a can here, which I can pick up. I have my litter picker and can bag with me, the cans I can pick up. In the water, though, there is some fast food cups, a daily occurrence, unfortunately.
Well, Richard Parry is Chief Executive of the Canal and River Trust and is online. Good morning to you. What state are they in at the moment, and what is your warning about what might happen if they don't get sufficient funding?
Good morning, Simon.
Good morning.
Well, it's a very old network. It's cared for by lots of volunteers like Jane, who we just heard from, but also the professional teams at the Canal and River Trust, the national charity that cares for our canal network. And we work very hard to keep the network open and alive. But with more extreme weather events, with pressure on budgets, we've had inflation, of course, in recent years. That means that the money's being spread further all the time. And the range of benefits we deliver to all the communities you talked about, providing access to nature on the doorstep for literally millions of people, corridors for nature that are so vital for wildlife. The importance of canals means that we have to secure the investment that is needed. Now, the public can play a role in that. We call for donations and support from the public. But because so much of this very old infrastructure, 10,000 individual assets, any one of which can cause a canal to empty, can cause it to become unsafe, it's vital that we renew that partnership with government to deliver the long-term investment that our canal network vitally needs if it's to continue to deliver this vast range of benefits.
Before we talk numbers and what's needed, just clarify who's responsible for their upkeep. Local authorities, central government? I mean, Birmingham's got more, famously, of course, got more canals than Venice. I mean, is that not a local authority issue? Is it a central government issue?
Cared for by the Canal and River Trust. We're a national charity. We were set up 12 years ago with the sole purpose of caring for our canal network and opening up the potential for its use by more people and securing its long-term future. And we've been very successful in developing further use, growing people's involvement with canals. But the ongoing cost of their maintenance and repair is rising all the time. And that's the real challenge we face. And we look at the benefits it can provide in terms of things like water security. Those connected canal networks are now moving water to areas where it's needed for water supply. There's lots of new innovative use the canal network can be used for, but it all requires that fundamental underlying investment to keep that core infrastructure in a good and safe condition.
Yeah, DEFRA say you get £52.6 million. How much more do you need to keep up with the basics?
Well, we need that to match inflation. So we've been at 52 million since 2020. The last government announced it would decline over the next 10, 12 years to be about 30 million. And that's against, of course, inflation rising all the time. So although we're working really hard to grow income from other sources, we're calling out to people to support our work. Everyone who values and enjoys their canals can make a donation and become a friend of the trust. We do need that reset of a partnership with government that recognises if we want to keep the range of benefits this incredible network provides, it does need a level of investment. We mustn't take them for granted, because otherwise that wide range of benefits could be lost.
And have you had these discussions? I mean, Steve Reed is obviously the Environment Secretary, but ultimately this will be a decision for Rachel Reeves, who's got a lot of competing bids on the public purse. Have you had any discussions?
We look forward to discussions. We've had some initial discussions. We know how much there is for the new government to address. This is about the long term. This isn't about a short term immediate need. This is about looking to the long term and saying, what's the level of investment that we have to deliver to keep this network that pays back many times over? The economic benefits are £1.5 billion a year alone. 80,000 jobs are supported in marinas and boatyards and cafes and restaurants because the canal is there and is vibrant and alive. So there's a real strong business case for that partnership with government, not to fund us more than they do now, but just to retain and sustain the level of investment that this network will need to be safe and available for the future.
Okay. Richard Parry, Chief Executive of the Canal and River Trust, thanks for talking to us. It is 7:03. Let's get some weather with Thomas Schaffanacker. Hello again, Thomas.
Simon, thank you. Yes, the weather's fairly quiet at the moment, particularly across eastern and central parts of the UK. The south coast of England, fairly bright too, but clouds have now started to sweeping off the Atlantic, and it is a rain-bearing cloud which will eventually bring a fairly wet second half of the afternoon in Northern Ireland and Western Scotland. Also, the Irish Sea will become quite blustery, so I think rain expected around the Lake District and also into Lancashire. So these more northwestern areas today, eventually cloud and rain on the way, and the winds will be quite strong up to gale force around coastal areas. Also, our freshest weather in the northwest today, around 15 for Belfast, Glasgow, Edinburgh, the Lake District, and maybe the high teens across the northwest of England. Now, the rest of the country, so the rest of eastern England, central England, the south, Wales, here the weather should stay bright at least through most of the afternoon, if not relatively sunny around the coasts of East Anglia, the southeast of England, as well as the south coast. And here it'll also be warmest in the southeast, temperatures up to about 23 Celsius. And then tonight we've got yet more wet and windy weather sweeping through. It really will become quite blustery again. This is the next weather front that's coming our way. And a heads up for tomorrow, actually come the afternoon, that weather front should clear and we're in for a pretty decent day on Thursday with scattered clouds, the odd shower and pleasant conditions overall. Back to you.
Thanks very much, Thomas. Let's have a look forward to next week.
How to Play on BBC Radio 4.
You get inside the music and you're getting closer to what you think the composer was trying to say to the world.
Giving the inside view on beloved pieces of music.
It's like a treasure hunt in a way.
The music is more than just the notes.
Peeking into the rehearsal room.
I am the only professional one-handed concert pianist who has a soloist career. You know, it's not for the faint-hearted. We put ourselves through an awful lot of stress to walk out on stage to deliver ice in the veins, for sure.
How to Play on BBC Sounds and Radio 4, next Monday morning at 9:30.
In the next hour, we'll be talking to the daughter of one of the Israeli hostages whose body has been taken home from Gaza. We'll also be finding out how the probation service feels it will be able to cope when the number of prisoners released goes up sharply next month. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Simon Jack. It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 21st of August. The headlines this morning. The Home Office is recruiting 100 investigators to tackle people smuggling gangs and promising a surge in forcible removals of illegal immigrants. Michelle and Barack Obama have thrown their weight behind Kamala Harris's bid for the White House, telling the Democratic National Convention that hope is making a comeback. And remote-controlled vehicles are being used in the underwater search for six people missing after the yacht sank off Sicily. The BBC News is read by Lisa Costello.
The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has announced new details of the government's plan for a border security command to tackle illegal immigration. 100 new intelligence and investigations officers will be appointed this year to target smuggling gangs. And the government is promising a large surge in returns flights for people here illegally. The Conservatives say that by scrapping the plan to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda, Labour had shown they weren't serious about stopping the boats. More from our political correspondent Harry Farley.
More than 19,000 people have crossed the Channel in small boats so far this year, a 10% increase on last year, but a fall from the peak of more than 21,000 over the same period in 2022. Labour have abandoned the Rwanda policy. Instead, the government says these new specialist officers will increase the work the National Crime Agency is already doing to target gangs smuggling people across the Channel. They will work in the UK and across Europe, with some undercover and others targeting the supply of inflatable boats and equipment. Yvette Cooper is also promising a surge in forcible removals of people who are in the UK illegally. The Home Office has said it will continue with the previous government's plan to reopen two immigration centres near Oxford and Portsmouth, increasing their capacity to detain migrants.
Barack and Michelle Obama have told the Democratic Party convention that America is ready for a new chapter with Kamala Harris as president. On the second day of the event in Chicago, Mr. Obama attacked the Republican candidate Donald Trump as weird and stale. The former First Lady said that with Ms. Harris, hope was making a comeback. From Chicago, here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
There was high wattage star power on display at the Democratic National Convention as first Michelle and then Barack Obama took to the stage.
Okay, we got a big night ahead.
painting an optimistic picture of how they believe Democrats can win in November.
The vast majority of us do not want to live in a country that's bitter and divided.
Mr. Obama has been a longtime ally of Kamala Harris. She was a very early supporter of his first presidential campaign.
And the joy and the excitement that we're seeing around this campaign tells us we're not alone.
He gave a rousing endorsement of his friend and described Donald Trump as selfish, dangerous, and preparing to take America backwards.
Good evening, Milwaukee!
At the same time, Kamala Harris was in the swing state of Wisconsin, filling the same large arena in which Donald Trump accepted his party's presidential nomination last month. As her speech was beamed into the Chicago convention, she was in effect campaigning in two places at once, a recognition perhaps of how much work she needs to do between now and the election in November.
The search operation for six people missing after a luxury yacht sank off the coast of Sicily has entered its third day. The Italian authorities have said divers are struggling to get into the wreck of the Baysian, which went down in a storm on Monday with 22 people on board. Among the missing is the British tech entrepreneur Mike Lynch. The body of the yacht's chef has been recovered. Our correspondent Mark Lowen reports from Sicily.
For a third straight day, the divers will be racing to reach the cabin of the Baysian superyacht, helped by remote-controlled vehicles that can operate on the seabed for far longer than the rescuers themselves. It is no longer survivors that they are trying to find, but bodies of the six missing passengers, probably sleeping inside when the ship was hit by a tornado-like waterspout, which capsized it. Dr. Fabio Genco from the Palermo Emergency Medical Services treated the 15 survivors when they were brought ashore.
The word that all the injured kept repeating was darkness, the darkness that they experienced during the shipwreck. They spoke of about 5 minutes, from the moment the boat was lifted, raised by the waves of the sea, until it sank.
British investigators are here in Sicily working to assess the disaster and whether measures were taken on board to mitigate the extreme weather, like closing hatches. All secrets that the Baysian may have taken down with it to the bottom of the ocean.
The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has said a proposal for a Gaza ceasefire involves a detailed plan for the withdrawal of Israeli troops from the territory. He was responding to reported comments by Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, suggesting he'd persuaded Mr. Blinken his forces must stay. Our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman, is travelling with Mr. Blinken.
The reported comments by Mr. Netanyahu have angered the US administration, with one senior official suggesting they jeopardize progress towards a ceasefire. The Israeli leader was quoted as saying he had maybe convinced Mr. Blinken that the agreement must see Israeli troops remaining in key parts of Gaza, including along the border with Egypt. The comments came just as the Secretary of State was flying to meet Arab leaders, who the Americans want to entice Hamas into accepting an agreement urgently. Mr. Blinken revealed that the agreement involves what he called a detailed schedule for Israeli troop withdrawals from Gaza, but he wouldn't confirm the extent of their pullout. And so this increasingly fraught issue remains a major barrier to reaching a deal.
New data suggests the rising cost of renting has started to cool this year after a period of rapid increases. The figures shared with the BBC by the property portal Zoopla suggest rents for newly let homes are rising at their slowest rate for 3 years. Our cost of living correspondent Kevin Peachey has more.
In recent years, tenants have faced intense competition for homes and soaring rents when they move. Now, with demand easing, Zoopla says the rental sector in the UK has moved from red hot to hot. Fewer students renting privately in some areas, more first-time buyers getting onto the housing ladder, and some young renters saving money by moving back into the family home are among the suggested reasons for the slowdown. Rents may also have increased too fast for tenants to afford in some cities. But the data shows there are still 17 prospective tenants chasing each property on average. With rents 20% higher than a couple of years ago, people are compromising by lowering their expectations of a property or sharing with others.
A study suggests that eating just 2 slices of ham a day can raise the risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Scientists at the University of Cambridge also found a heightened risk from as little as 100 grams of unprocessed red meat a day, equivalent to a small steak. The findings have been published in the Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology Journal. More details from Joe Inwood.
By looking at data from nearly 2 million people, this study claims to have found the most concrete evidence yet that too much red meat, especially processed, raises your risk of type 2 diabetes. It found 50 grams of things like ham, bacon or sausages a day made you 15% more likely to develop the disease within the next 10 years. Unprocessed meat had a similar effect. 100 grams of beef, lamb or pork a day raises the risk by 10%. The authors said the study supported healthy eating recommendations to cut down meat intake.
Figures just released by the Office for National Statistics show the government borrowed £3.1 billion last month. That's £1.8 billion more than in July last year, and the highest July borrowing since 2021. Drones have been used successfully to deliver blood products between two hospitals in Northumberland. The trial by NHS Blood and Transplant and a medical logistics company examined how to reduce the carbon footprint of getting blood supplies around the country, as Rebecca Drought reports.
Researchers wanted to know if it was possible to send blood products by drone without compromising their quality. They sent identical stocks of red blood cell components from Wansbeck Hospital in Ashington to Alnwick Infirmary and back again, a distance of just over 40 miles. Writing in the British Journal of Haematology, the researchers said there were no significant differences in the biochemical or haematological profiles of the blood that was flown or driven. The chief medical officer at NHS Blood and Transplant described the results as promising. A similar trial for blood platelets is being planned.
Rebecca Drought reporting.
Thanks very much, Lisa. Just in the last few hours, former US President Barack Obama and Michelle Obama were taking the stage in Chicago to lend their political star power to endorse Kamala Harris to be the next president. As you heard in the headlines there, it was a high-energy, impassioned affair. They urged voters to back a new chapter with her in back-to-back speeches from the Obamas to a packed audience at the Democratic National Convention Center in Chicago. Justin is there for us, and I spoke to him a little while ago, and he told me what stood out for him in Barack Obama's speech.
His sole job, really, was to set a course for this entire convention towards that famous phrase that he made famous when he was running, and he used it right at the beginning of his speech. And the phrase is, I don't know about you, I'm feeling fired up and ready to go.
Fired up.
And he used to say that. I heard him say it again and again in the 2008 campaign, and it worked brilliantly because, although it's vague, it persuaded people that something was stirring, and it was something positive that was stirring. And just judging by the people actually rushing past me now for the exits, but with huge smiles on their faces, that is what Obama's job was today, he and Michelle, and that's what unquestionably, at least inside this hall, he has achieved. So not a list of policies, nothing like that, but this sense that there is something afoot, and it's something positive, and it's something that can lead to victory in November.
Yes, and he tried to liken Kamala's campaign a little bit to his own, saying that there's a chance that someone with an unusual name can get somewhere, talking about himself and presumably likening that to Kamala Harris.
Yeah, I mean, his view is that there can still be room in American politics, even now, for positivity and for aisle-crossing happiness, as it were, for hands to reach out to hands. And his entire speech was kind of predicated on the idea that America is still the place that he described in his long arrival into office. So the long campaign that started actually way back before 2008. And it's a point he made again, and he made it with humor. So he was critical of Trump, no doubt about that. But one thing really struck me when other politicians, including Joe Biden, talk in detail about the threat that they say Donald Trump poses, and they talk in detail about the things that he has said, about the things that he wants to do if he gets back into office, Obama kind of dismissed it. He dismissed Trump with humor, and then he said to the crowd, he said, you know, we've seen this movie before, and the sequel, he said, is not normally as good.
We do not need four more years of bluster and bumbling and chaos. us. We have seen that movie before, and we all know that the sequel is usually worse.
Moments like this are designed to give momentum towards November. Is there always a sort of positive reaction in after the hoo-ha and the jamboree of a convention?
Well, yeah, I mean, there always has been in the past. You look for a bounce, a polling bounce. It's a bit different this year because so many peculiar things, unprecedented things have happened, really, or certainly the fact of them all happening together is unprecedented. This has been the oddest summer in American politics, certainly in modern times. So who knows whether there'll be a polling bounce. But the really grueling work starts once September comes, and specifically, I suppose, once this debate happens between her and Donald Trump on September the 10th. Until then, I think it's impossible to say, really, that anything important in opinion terms comes from this convention. It's more the setting of the stage for the kind of campaign that the Democrats want to fight and think can be successful. That's the importance of this week.
Justin, thank you. Justin Webb there in Chicago.
13 minutes past seven. The government's announcement today on tackling boats across the channel includes an emphasis on removing people. A large surge in enforcement and returns flights, the Home Office says, with the aim of removals reaching their highest level since 2018. Nearly 300 more beds will also open at two immigration removal centres. Let's look at the removals figures first with Dr. Peter Walsh, senior researcher at the Migration Observatory. Dr. Walsh, first of all, on the comparison between 2018 and now, were there many more removals in 2018 than last year?
Well, the first thing to point out is that we assume that the government is referring to enforced removals because there were more voluntary removals where people depart voluntarily in 2023 than 2018. So if we look at enforced removals, last year there were 6,000. In 2018, there were 9,000. So this would require 3,000 more, a 50% increase, which sounds achievable. The other thing to point out is that 2018 is not an especially high bar. Apart from the pandemic, that was the lowest number of enforced removals in 20 years. So it looks like an achievable goal, but it's a pretty low bar.
So it's not an especially ambitious level. They could have said, for example, get back to 2015 levels, where I think the return numbers were significantly higher.
That's right, yes. So in 2015, they were closer to 15,000. And actually, that's several thousand lower than 20 years ago. In 2004, there were 21,000. So it's a moderate goal and an achievable. It's not a fanciful target. It's realistic.
Why are returns so difficult, the enforced returns, what most people would understand as deportations?
The reasons aren't entirely clear. Now, the government has for many years cited legal challenges made by individuals to their removal. There's not sufficient evidence on how important that is and whether those challenges have increased substantially over time. It could result from less effective enforcement activity. An immigration enforcement budget has indeed fallen in recent years. And another plausible explanation is that more people in the UK without immigration status, they're just from countries to which we remove few people. So countries like Iraq and Iran, those are countries with which we don't have functioning returns agreements. And many people now are coming from countries like that. So that's probably another part
of the
explanation.
But is it not only that we don't have returns agreements, but it would be that probably people who have come here from those countries might well have a well-founded fear of persecution that would make them eligible for asylum?
Yes, and you know, historically those people have claimed asylum and in recent years have had a very high success rate. You know, people crossing in small boats where they have had their claims processed, over 80% have received a grant of asylum. The remainder, of course, those who have been refused. Well, we look at the data and in recent years we've just been finding it really difficult to remove people who have been refused. And that's because they're coming from countries to which the UK just returns few people, in addition to Iraq and Iran, Bangladesh, Pakistan. Historically, in recent years, we have a pretty low success rate in returning refused asylum seekers from those countries.
Peter Walsh, thank you very much. And Enver Solomon, the Chief Executive of the Refugee Council, is also with us. What do you think of what the Home Office is saying today?
Well, I think it's really important to recognise that if someone's asylum claim is rejected, steps should be taken to try and remove them, and that is understandable. But what Peter Walsh failed to point out is that the vast majority of people removed do it voluntarily. They do it when they're supported in a dignified way to return. And instead of wasting taxpayers' money on expanding detention places, the government should be investing in what are called voluntary returns programs. And I think if you treat people with respect and humanity and support them to return, many more people will return. Two-thirds of people who have their asylum claim rejected return voluntarily. That is what the government should be supporting people to do, supporting them in the community to return, not building more detention places.
But it's 290 spaces, isn't it? It's not thousands and thousands. It's 290 beds that are being created in these removal centres. For people in the category that you say you wouldn't object, people whose claims have been rejected and who might well abscond otherwise, is it so wrong if it's on a short-term basis and they do not have a right to be in this country?
Well, it was really interesting. When Sajid Javid was Home Secretary, a Conservative Home Secretary, he recognised that the cost of detention was extortionate. It didn't provide good value for money. The treatment of people in detention is very poor. And he invested in pilots in the community to look at how people can be supported to return voluntarily. And the evidence from those pilots was very successful. What the government should be doing is actually looking at the state of the detention system. The last chief inspector's report into a centre found a situation, in his words, that was truly shocking. And he said he left deeply concerned that some of those held there were at imminent risk of harm. Detention is costly. It results in people harming themselves. It results in huge damage to people's mental health. And the government shouldn't be investing in detention. It should be investing in alternative detention. The other thing it should be doing, recognizing that, of course, security matters to stop the boats, and no one wants the people smugglers to profit. It also needs to recognize that if people are coming from Afghanistan, from Iran, where repressive regimes chase down their opponents, and from Sudan and Syria, where there's civil war, we need to provide those people with safe routes to come here. But their families, their men, women, and children, we work with them at the Refugee Council. They come here because they're refugees seeking safety. And unless the government also provides safe routes, it won't succeed in stopping the boats.
Enver Solomon from the Refugee Council, thank you.
Government borrowing in July was almost £2 billion higher this year than it was in 2023, according to figures just released by the Office for National Statistics. So, Will Bain, that stronger than expected economic growth not showing up in the public finances, at least yet.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you'll know, Simon, this figure, a bit of a surprise too, higher than a lot of the estimates, including from the likes of the OBR. Yeah, this is the ONS's data on public sector finances, and they found net borrowing was £3.1 billion in July 2024, £1.8 billion more than in July 2023, and the highest July borrowing since 2021. Carl Emerson, Deputy Director at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, is with us. Carl, morning.
Good morning.
What did you make of the numbers?
Well, I think they're a bit disappointing, for sure. If you look over the first 4 months of the financial year, so April through to the end of July, the government's borrowed almost £5 billion more than what was forecast in the March budget. And if you break that down on the receipts side, it looks like government receipts are coming in pretty close to what was forecast, very slightly below. So, as you say, that's disappointing in the sense that we've had good news on the economy. We might have thought that would be feeding into good news on tax receipts. We're not seeing that. And then on the spending side, which is the real driver of why we're borrowing more than was expected, we see that central government departments on public services are spending more than was expected, almost £6 billion more so far this year. And what that means is we're a third of the way through the financial year. And if you look at all previous years, the government's always spent below a third of the departmental budgets in the first third of the year. But so far this year, they've already spent 34%. And when you look at government borrowing, that 1% up on spending is actually a big number.
Right, because in the statement we've had from the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Darren Jones, this morning, he's pointing at paying down the debt, basically servicing the debt, as being a major problem. But you're saying as well, department spending here is up too. What's causing that?
Well, it looks like there are a lot of government departments under pressures, and Rachel Reeves, the new Chancellor, set out last month how she thought that spending this year was likely to be higher than what she had anticipated. And these figures are consistent with government departments ending up spending more than what was budgeted back in March. So, for example, you've just been talking about the cost of supporting asylum seekers in the UK. That's one area where spending just looks like it's going to be much higher than what departments budgeted for back in March.
And a quick thought, Carl, as well, because Darren Jones in that statement has said today's figures are yet more proof of the dire inheritance left to us by the previous government. Your assessment of that claim?
Well, the public finances are in a very difficult state. That was going to be true whoever was Chancellor after the election. The outlook for growth doesn't look that great. We've got a lot of debt and it's now costing us more to finance. So getting debt down was always going to be a struggle. And we also know that the spending plans that have been penciled in for the years beyond April looked incredibly tight. And Jeremy Hunt, the previous Chancellor, had made them pretty tight in order to finance the national insurance cuts we had. So much of the difficulties in the public finances was known before the election. And it is going to be a very difficult budget for the new Chancellor.
Carl, thank you very much for your time this morning. Carl Emerson there, the Deputy Director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies.
And thank you, Will. 23 minutes past seven, the search is continuing for the six people missing after a super yacht sank off the coast of Sicily after being hit by a tornado-like waterspout. The missing include the UK entrepreneur Mike Lynch, who was on a cruise with his lawyer, business associates and friends to celebrate his acquittal of fraud charges after 13 years of litigation. Mark Lowen is our correspondent in Italy. And Mark, it is now more than 48 hours since the boat sunk. Are the authorities effectively looking for bodies, not survivors now?
I think that's the case, yes, Simon. I mean, the Italian Coast Guard say, in their words, never say never, but it is very unlikely that they're going to find anybody alive now. They are still struggling to get inside the divers to the cabin area of the wreckage of the Baysian, which is 50 metres, about 150 feet below water on the seabed, because the ship is largely intact. They've got inside the lounge area, but they're now trying to push further into the cabins where they believe that the passengers were probably sleeping when the storm hit and when the water spout hit in the early hours of Monday morning, and they think that that is where they will find the remains and the bodies of the six missing passengers. But while the diving process continues, so does the investigation, because the huge questions remain over how this giant yacht, 56 metres, it had the tallest aluminium mast in the world, went down so quickly within a matter of seconds or just a couple of minutes, while actually when you see from CCTV footage from the port, much smaller boats withstand the force of the winds. And therefore the questions will be over whether the hatches on the yacht were open, allowing water to pour in, whether the retractable keel of the ship, of the yacht was deployed in order to give it more stability while it was anchored offshore, and whether there was anything else that could have been done to mitigate the bad weather that was in the area.
And have the accounts of the survivors yielded anything in terms of trying to piece together exactly what happened?
Not publicly, at least. I mean, I went to a hotel where the survivors are staying just up from the shore, but it is completely off limits to journalists, and it's become, in a sense, a kind of bunker. It's where the survivors are. It's where the British marine investigators who have been sent from the UK are now staying as well, gathering information. Nothing is coming out publicly. The key figure, of course, Simon, is going to be the captain, James Catfield, who is from New Zealand. He survived, and he will provide much-needed information. But really, there are still big questions over how this happened. And in terms of the actual diving effort, well, that will go on again today, but one of the issues that the divers face is because this ship is so low, is so deep, they're only allowed a minute to go down to the seabed, and then 10 minutes underwater, and then a minute back up for their own safety before they need to resurface. They're also working with remote control vehicles that can patrol the seabed for up to 2 hours, so much longer than the rescuers themselves can have, but it's an incredibly challenging operation.
Indeed. Okay, Mark, thank you. Mark Lowen, our correspondent in Italy.
26 minutes past seven. We've been taking some time on the programme this year to follow a river, the Avon, looking at it and the people who treasure it and use it from different angles. A swimming group based at Conham River Park on the Avon in Bristol has been collecting water samples, and the latest they have tested has come back with some pretty stark results. Eva Perrin is a freshwater ecologist who swims with the group. Good morning, Eva.
Hi, good morning.
And what has this latest sample found?
Yeah, so we took a sample last Friday, and this is just part of a kind of wider monitoring program that we've been undertaking at Conham over the last three summers. And in general, the samples are, you know, the results are showing that generally the river is fairly polluted, although it does fluctuate. But the last couple of weeks, the samples have shown really, really high levels of fecal bacteria. So that's kind of bacteria that wouldn't naturally occur in the river. It's indicative of the presence of sewage or maybe agricultural runoff and something like that. And whilst there isn't really a safe kind of limit below which or above which is, you know, safe or unsafe, the sample that we got back from last week was probably around 20 times higher than, you know, what the benchmark would be considered to be unsafe.
What has the water looked like in recent weeks? How does it compare visually to what you've seen in previous summers, the comparable periods?
It's quite hard to tell because it fluctuates quite a lot. And obviously we've had a bit of a rainy summer this year, which causes a lot of runoff. And it's a lowland river, so it's, you know, it has a lot of kind of, you know, floating particulates in it, a lot of organic matter. It's very coloured naturally. And so you can't necessarily always tell that there's pollution in there. But, you know, when I went to sample on Friday, it looked as good as it looks ever, really.
And then you get the sample back. Yeah, I just wondered, whose job is it to test the samples of this stretch of river? Because I'm struck by the fact that you're doing it yourself.
Yeah, well, technically for this stretch of river, it's not really anybody's job to test the river for, you know, what we're testing it for, which is, you know, indicators of sewage pollution, you know, stuff that is harmful to humans. Every few years, the Environment Agency tests it for like an ecological health check as part of the Water Framework Directive. But yeah, in terms of testing it for things harmful to humans, it's not really anybody's job because it's not officially a designated bathing water.
And would you like to change that?
Yeah, so this is part of our campaign, is to try and apply for designation to DEFRA. So that would mean that the Environment Agency would have to test the water quality regularly, once a week between May and September, and kind of investigate any sources of pollution. Yeah, we're coming up against a bit of trouble doing that, really. There's actually a bylaw, a local bylaw, which prevents swimming. And for that reason, we're struggling to get the permission from the landowner, which is the council, Bristol City Council in our case, in order to make that application.
OK, we did ask Wessex Water, which is the local water company in the area, about this. And they say lowland rivers will always have bacteria in them, and the safety of wild swimming at specific locations is for councils and other bodies to determine.
Okay, it's interesting. The council usually say that it's the water company's responsibility.
Right, so you're kind of between a rock and a hard place there.
Yeah, for sure. People sort of tend to blame each other, really. And I think all we want is for people to talk to each other and kind of, you know, put measures in place to improve. And what Wessex said about the high bacteria levels is, you know, it is true, there's naturally high levels of bacteria in the lowland river, but you know, this particular type of bacteria should not be there anywhere near the levels that it is if there weren't pollution.
Eva Perrin from Conham Bathing Group, thank you.
Time for some sport with Mike Williams, and more on that rumpus in the world of tennis.
Yes, Simon, yeah, let's get some more, shall we, on that ongoing row in tennis that that is threatening to overshadow the start of the US Open this weekend. We've learnt in the last 24 hours that world number one and reigning Australian Open champion Jannik Sinner escaped a ban from playing despite twice testing positive for the anabolic agent Clostobol in March of this year. Well, our tennis correspondent Russell Fuller joins us now. Russell, perhaps you could start by just telling us how we got here. Well, what is the reason being given for Sinner having this banned substance in his system?
Good morning, Mike. Well, the argument put forward, which was accepted by an independent tribunal, was that the source of the Clostobol, which can increase muscle mass, was a hand spray that Jannik Sinner's physio was using to treat a cut on his own finger. And that hand spray initially belonged to the Italian's fitness trainer. He bought it in Italy a few weeks before and suggested the physio use some when he cut his finger on a scalpel when reaching into his treatment bag soon after the team arrived in Indian Wells in California for a tournament in March. The physio then carried out massages and foot treatments on Sinner without gloves. I think there are some questions for the wider team there. And because Sinner had dermatitis on his feet, I know this is too much information, and small lesions on his skin, he subsequently tested positive. For very low amounts, Sinner's lawyer actually says it amounted to less than a billionth of a gram.
Yeah, struggling to even work out how you measure one billionth of a gram, but there you go. What then has been the reason that Sinner has been able to avoid a ban from playing altogether?
Well, ultimately, because the independent tribunal ruled last week that he bore no fault or negligence for what happened, that he had done everything in his power to reduce the risk of something like this happening, and also that he had employed people with knowledge of anti-doping on his team. The other question people are asking is, why was he not issued a mandatory provisional suspension when the news came to light? And the answer is, he was. He was briefly automatically banned when the positive tests were discovered. But he successfully appealed those decisions, and therefore he did not have to step back from the tour, as Simona Halep and the British player Tara Moore have done while the investigation and hearing were taking place.
And just briefly, Russell, what has been the response from other leading players on the tour to this ruling? Because several of them have not held back, have they?
No, we've seen some quite emotive responses from players. Nick Kyrgios is certainly of the view that if you had a banned substance in your system, your performance was enhanced and therefore you should be banned for 2 years. The Canadian Denis Shapovalov says different rules for different players. And Lucas Pouy said in French, perhaps stop taking us for fools. It was certainly a speedy process, Mike. That's one thing I would say. This case was more straightforward than many others, but was concluded within 5 months, whereas some can take well over a year.
This one threatening to rumble on as we head towards the start of the US Open this weekend. Russell Fuller heading out there himself to cover that Grand Slam. Many thanks for your time this morning. Just time to tell you that the first test between England and Sri Lanka begins today at Old Trafford. We will look ahead to that in the next hour of the programme with Sir Alistair Cook. And the tips are back today before the start of York's Ebor Festival this afternoon, one of the last major race meetings of the flat season. So our selections there come in the 2:25 for number 11, Yarug, and then at 3:35, number 11, Calandagan.
Thank you, Mike.
On BBC iPlayer.
When I'm around cricket, I seem to forget everything else. And I want these lads to experience that.
Freddie Flintoff reunites with his Preston cricket team.
Hey, you. All right, lads.
I've missed you.
For their greatest adventure yet. India.
Everything's so different.
I've never been anywhere like it.
Biggest cricket playing nation in the world.
You can feel the team spirit. It's back.
Freddie Flintoff's Field of Dreams on tour.
We're representing England, but we're representing something far bigger than that. We're representing Preston.
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
Today's weather. Today will be cloudy across the north with outbreaks of rain, which will turn heavy and persistent across the west of Scotland. The south, cloudy but largely dry.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4, where Lisa Costello has a summary of the news.
The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has given more details of plans for a border security command to tackle illegal immigration. 100 new intelligence and investigations officers will be brought into the National Crime Agency this year to target smuggling gangs. The government says there'll also be a surge in return flights for migrants here illegally. Government borrowing rose by more than expected to £3.1 billion last month, marking the highest July borrowing since 2021. The Office for National Statistics said the figure was £1.8 billion higher than in July last year. Barack and Michelle Obama have delivered passionate endorsements of Kamala Harris on the second day of the US Democratic Party convention, saying America was ready for a new chapter with her as president. The former First Lady said hope was making a comeback. Mr. Obama also attacked the Republican candidate Donald Trump as weird, selfish and dangerous. The search operation is entering a third day for the six people who are missing after a boat sank off the coast of Sicily on Monday. The British tech entrepreneur Mike Lynch and the Morgan Stanley International Bank chairman Jonathan Bloomer are among those unaccounted for. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said a proposal for a Gaza ceasefire deal involves a detailed plan for Israeli troop withdrawals from the territory. He was responding to reported comments by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, suggesting that he had persuaded Mr. Blinken that Israeli forces must stay in strategic parts of Gaza. At least 28 pilgrims from Pakistan have died in a bush crash in Iran. The vehicle was travelling to Iraq for a religious ritual when it reportedly overturned and caught fire. 23 other people are believed to have been injured. New data suggests the rising cost of renting has started to cool this year after a period of rapid increases. The figures shared with the BBC by the property portal Zoopla suggest rents for newly let homes are rising at their slowest rate for 3 years.
Lisa, thank you. Antony Blinken is on his way home this morning after the last stage of a Middle East trip that included Doha and Cairo as well as Jerusalem. He now wants Egypt and Qatar to pressure Hamas to agree to a ceasefire. Unhelpful to that were comments reportedly made by the Israeli Prime Minister after he left that Mr. Netanyahu had said he had convinced the US Israel should be allowed to keep troops on the border between Gaza and Egypt. Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman is travelling with the Secretary of State and had the chance to question him directly about this. So I asked Tom to explain his understanding of what Antony Blinken thinks Israel has agreed to.
Well, the starting point here was on Monday, where Antony Blinken and Benjamin Netanyahu had a three-hour meeting. After that, you know, we were all in Tel Aviv. Mr. Blinken came out and in a short press conference said that Mr. Netanyahu had agreed to what they are calling the American bridging proposal. This is the proposal designed to bridge the gaps, to bring Israel and Hamas closer together in terms of getting this ceasefire deal. But crucially, the terms of it have not be made public. Now, as we were then flying to Egypt, news emerged in an Israeli press report that Mr. Netanyahu had met some hostage families and told them that he had, in his words, perhaps convinced Mr. Blinken that Israeli troops would have to stay in certain strategic parts of Gaza as part of the ceasefire agreement, namely the so-called Philadelphia Corridor, the southern Gaza Strip, the border with Egypt, and what they're calling the Netzarim Corridor. That's the centre of Gaza. That would, in effect, split Gaza in two. Now, my sense is that that comment, as it circulated, has deeply irritated the US administration. One senior administration official saying that, or accusing Mr. Netanyahu of making what they called a maximalist statement that isn't constructive to getting a ceasefire deal across the line, because Hamas completely rejects any idea of keeping Israeli troops on the ground in Gaza. And then in Doha last night, as we were about to leave, I asked Antony Blinken himself about this, and he said, and revealed really for the first time, that within that bridging proposal are measures to allow for the withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza. He said, according to a detailed schedule, although when I said, does that mean the full withdrawal, he wouldn't be drawn on that and didn't confirm that.
But do you get the impression that the US administration is expecting Israeli troops to withdraw from Gaza as part of this deal, and that's why they're saying to Hamas, you must accept this now? Or whether there might be some form of Israeli military presence in Gaza?
And my sense of the feeling of irritation within the administration is they're trying to make it clear, particularly so that message gets through via the Egyptian and Qatari mediators to Hamas, you know, that there is a plan for withdrawal, and they're talking about how long it takes and in which locations and numbers of troops and that sort of thing. That's in this bridging proposal. But it doesn't seem like they're saying there would be a full withdrawal during this phased ceasefire agreement. But clearly that's the part that still needs to be hammered out, and it's why it's become a very fraught issue, but also one of the key sticking points now, because the two sides are in totally different positions on this issue.
Well, one of the six hostages whose body was recovered yesterday from Gaza was Chaim Perry. He was 80 and he lived in Kibbutz near Oz. On October the 7th, he and his wife were hiding in their safe room as their house was attacked. Later, as the safe room was broken into, he walked out voluntarily, and that was how his wife was saved, because Hamas did not spot her and he did not give away that she was there. He was a father of five, and I've been speaking to his daughter, Inbal Perry, who told me about the period afterwards and how the family had some signs that he was still alive.
Hamas sent a video of the three older people, my father and two of his friends, when they were in the tunnels. And before that, the elderly women that came out, that came home, also told us that they were with him and that he was really okay. That is more or less the last thing that we heard from him. And now we know that they probably died around February.
What makes you say that or believe that?
It's something that the army is, when they came to inform us on June, they came to inform us that he's not alive anymore. They have their, you know, way of knowing things, what happened, when it happened. It is connected to our military actions.
I've been reading about your father. Tell me about him.
I'm not going to, you know, talk about a lot about my father right now. You know, it's a very painful period of time. He was a peace activist, and his whole life he was active to do a lot of peace actions. He was a people person. He was very creative.
And do you believe that there were opportunities for this to end another way for your father, to bring him back alive before February?
Of course, for sure, 100%. My father and his friend should have come home alive. Only depends on our government and the man who's standing in our prime minister, who had different priorities. He had political priorities. And that makes us very, very angry and frustrated.
You mean because of their age, that they would have been, had there been ceasefire negotiations or the prospect of a deal at that time, you think your father would have been amongst those released?
Of course. They should have been in the next talks. And it didn't happen only because our government and our prime minister had different priorities.
And when you say different priorities, do you mean the political priorities such as the staying in power and the survival of the coalition, or
yes,
or the desire to defeat Hamas militarily and end this through the use of force?
It's, of course, politically. In terms of the war, of course, it's war. I'm not saying, you know, that we could really stop the war, but we had to do the negotiations instead of keep on fighting. We saw for over 10 months that it's not working. Maybe the military actions put some pressure on Hamas at first, but then for 10 months, it's not working. As soon as there's any chance of talks and negotiations, it's falling down. We know it from inside information that our prime minister, it's not his first priority to end this war and to bring all the hostages home. And what's happening now, that he will keep bringing us bodies and not live hostages. That's the sad thing of the story. It's not over yet. For my family, maybe it's a small closure. It's not the right word to say happy, but for us, you know, this is the end of the way, and we are burying my father in the place that he loved so much. But for other hostages, they are still alive. And the chances that they will come back alive are getting smaller.
Inbal, did you ever have the chance to put this directly to Mr. Netanyahu or to members of the Israeli government? Because he has met some hostage families. Is it some rather than all?
Many people from the government did talk to us and try to help and do the best they can. But when the head is wrong, then it doesn't matter. I don't want to speak to my prime minister because I don't believe a word he's saying. I want him to say to my family and to all the other family, I'm sorry, I was wrong, and now I'm going home. There is another thing that it's important for me to say. The living is more important right now. You know, our soldiers, our army is doing tremendous efforts and army operations to rescue bodies. We don't want that. We want to have talks. We want that the government and our prime minister will go ahead and have a deal and have something to talk about instead of risking over and over again our soldiers to bring back bodies. We don't want any more soldiers to be killed. Stop the war. Stop everything. Make something that could lead to a deal, that will lead for talks to end the thing and to bring back all the hostages, because they are still alive. And their time is really running out.
In Balperri, thank you very much. Well, Mr. Netanyahu put out a statement after Chaim Peri and five other bodies were returned yesterday, saying the state of Israel will continue to make every effort to return all our hostages, the living and the dead. And last night he met one group of hostage families. His office said he told them, "We are with all our strength dismantling the Hamas regime and eliminating their military capability. At the same time, we're making an effort to return the abducted and preserve our strategic security assets."
It is 12 minutes to 8. Summer is still just about with us, and so is our Children's Summer Book Club. And this week we've been talking about nature books with our panel. As part of that, the author Frank Cottrell Boyce asked people to get in touch with any suggestions of books which could be seen as a modern-day parallel of Arthur Ransom's Swallows and Amazons. Roz Jones took up the challenge by sending us this voice note.
The Strong Wind series of seven books, which begins with the Salt Seine book, has been nicknamed the 21st Century Swallows and Amazons. These are exciting family stories full of fresh air, bravery and initiative. Most importantly, you don't have to be a child or to have read Arthur Ransom to enjoy them. The author Julia Jones was brought up sailing Arthur Ransom's former yacht, Peter Duck, around the East Coast rivers where Ransom set some of his most memorable books. These stories are similarly inspired by the creeks and rivers of the grey North Sea. Apart from being such a good read, one of my main reasons for recommending the series is the emphasis on diversity and inclusivity. Not all the children are living comfortable lives. The troubles that beset them are 21st century problems, from health and safety to people smuggling.
Thank you very much for that. The Strong Winds trilogy is that recommendation, including the salt-stained book. That takes us to Thought for the Day, which is with Professor Tina Beattie, writer and Catholic theologian.
Good morning. The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has recently ordered a review which will look at tackling violence against women and girls as a form of extremism. Preparing to do Thought for the Day, I sometimes look for stories hidden beneath the headlines. There's never a week that goes by without reports of murdered women, usually as bylines to the main news of the day. Sometimes public fear is allayed by the information that the murderer was known to the victim, or it was a domestic incident, as if being killed by someone you have perhaps loved and trusted makes the news less shocking. Whether it's a random attack by a stranger or by a partner or family member, the killing of women, or femicide, is rarely, if ever, described as a hate crime. Yet such murders are at the furthest extreme of a spectrum of misogynistic language and behaviour that can run like a poison through the bloodstream of culture and religion. I doubt there's a woman listening to this who doesn't have a story to tell. In the Christian tradition, misogyny has been given biblical justification by blaming Eve for bringing sin and death into the world. This idea is deeply rooted in cultures shaped by Christian interpretations of the book of Genesis. It fuels the belief that the female sex is a dangerous threat to men, even driving them to violence. Instead of tackling the problem of male violence, blame is projected onto women who are still often held responsible for provoking men to attack them. Yet I also believe that there is a promise hidden in plain sight at the heart of the Gospels, that if women were the first to be blamed, they are also the first to be redeemed. The women around Jesus are portrayed as his faithful followers and friends, praised for their courage, perseverance, and faith. When he's asked to join in the condemnation of a woman accused of adultery and about to be stoned, he turns the lens on the violent mob. Let the one without sin cast the first stone. It takes two to commit adultery. Where was the man? How many of the men in that murderous crowd were adulterers? I believe that in the example of Jesus, there is a model of non-violent love, which is a rebuke to the institutional church's long and continuing traditions of patriarchy and male privilege. That is, for me, a message worth struggling for, especially in a world in which violence against women remains so routine as to be hardly worth noticing. I hope that at last we may be willing to call it by its rightful name, a hate crime.
Tina Beattie with Thought for the Day at 8 minutes to 8.
Prisons in England and Wales are pretty much full. The government has already announced emergency measures to tackle overcrowding that include early release, automatic early release for non-violent offenders when they've served 40% of their sentence. Now, that comes into force in September, but some inmates are already being released up to 70 days early from a previous government scheme from particularly overcrowded prisons. But a report from the Chief Inspector of Prisons found this process, this early release, was often chaotic and rushed, with a quarter of prisoners released homeless, that often leading to reoffending and a recall to prison. So what is going to happen when the numbers released early jump when the new measures come in? Well, Lloyd Whiteley is co-founder of New Ethos Nottingham Housing, which provides temporary accommodation and support for low-medium supervision offenders leaving prison. He says that conversations about accommodation for those being released from prison are happening too late.
The process is supposed to start, and this is in all prisons, it's supposed to start 3 months before. Because of the lack of probation staff, et cetera, that process is usually starting a couple of weeks before they're going to get released. And that causes so much problems in terms of it's a race against time to try and get them accommodation. And 9 times out of 10, it's not achieved. Then the ex-prisoner finds themselves in limbo. They've got nowhere to go. And they think the only option is to go back into prison, where they've got the security of 3 meals a day and a bed.
Well, Martin Jones is His Majesty's Chief Inspector of Probation and is on the line. Good morning to you, Martin Jones.
Good morning.
By solving one problem, getting rid of a lot of people out of an overcrowded prison system, are we creating another nightmare for the probation service?
So I think it would be fair to say that the probation service is under huge pressure. And obviously the changes which come into effect on the 10th of September will increase that pressure on probation services. Now, we know from our work the early preparation for release, ensuring people have the support they need in the community and a place to live, is really crucial for preventing that reoffending, as Lloyd just said in his comments. But obviously the government faces a very difficult situation given the level of overcrowding in our prisons. Something needed to be done. Of course, the test will be, come the 10th of September, how effectively the probation service have prepared for that change.
And do you feel you've got the preparation and the funding that you need to deal with this sudden jump in early releases?
I think it's important to be clear. I'm the Chief Inspector of Probation, so it's my job to scrutinise the service and what is happening. Now, when I obviously heard the first news of the early release scheme, my concern was how much time would the probation service have to prepare for that? I was actually quite pleased that they had about 8 weeks. Now, 8 weeks isn't very much time, but I think it gave them a fighting chance to prepare for this. And on my inspection visits that I take place regularly, I've seen a huge amount of work taking place. Indeed, I'll describe it as heroism by probation to try to ensure that the best arrangements possible are in place. But of course, my job going forward will be to scrutinise how effective those plans have been. And I won't know the answer to that question until we start inspecting those cases.
But as the scrutineer in chief of the probation service, where do you suspect that the weaknesses lie? Where are the vulnerabilities?
So I think there are two things that come together here. And obviously, I think the important picture to paint here is obviously there has been a tension on the pressure on our prisons. The pressure on probation, I think, is equal, if not greater. And there are two particular areas, one of which is staffing. The probation service doesn't have the probation officers it needs to deliver its core caseload. And therefore, what you see is probation officers with an excessive caseload. And therefore, there is a limit on what you can properly do as a result of that. Now, if you're looking to release somebody from prison, the most important thing is to understand the risk that that person represents. Are they a high-risk offender? Are they a low-risk offender? What are their needs? Do they have mental health difficulty? Do they, for example, have drug addiction problems? If you do not understand that at the point that person is released, it's a recipe for failure. Quite often that will result in recall to prison, as Lloyd commented earlier. Alternatively, it results in increased reoffending. Now, we know that good probation practice keeps communities safe and reduces reoffending, but they need the staff and the resources to do that. Mm. And at the moment, I fear that the caseload is too high to do that well enough in all cases. And that's something that I think will require urgent attention going forward.
Do you think that there are two considerations here? There's the needs of the offender who's being released and the needs of society. Do you think we've got the balance right in protecting those two camps?
So the really important thing for me, if you look at the way the system works, is information. Do you understand from the risk that this person represents what their risk is? And in particular, there are two particular concerns that we've picked up in previous inspection reports. Is this person a risk to women? Is this person a potential risk to children? And that is really about capturing that information from the police, from local authorities, from prison intelligence, and ensuring that is relayed to the probation service. If you have that, that's a basic building block in relation to your understanding of that risk. But then in the community, the question is, what are you going to do with that information if you understand that risk? Okay. And that then involves sharing that information, working out what those plans would be. And where you see probation at its best, they are sharing that risk with other agencies, for example, working with the police in relation to domestic abuse allegations. So that's the really crucial part. Okay. And our recent inspection reports have found that there is more to do in that area.
OK, thank you. Martin Jones there, His Majesty's Chief Inspector of Probation. Before that, Lloyd Whiteley, co-founder of the New Ethos Nottingham Housing.
The weather now, which is with Thomas Schaffernacker.
Michelle, thank you. A lot of bright and even gloriously sunny weather at the moment across the UK, from the east coast of Scotland, past Dundee, Newcastle, all the way down to the East Anglia coastline and also the Channel coast. So we're waking up to sunny skies here. Bright inland too, but out towards the west, clouds are increasing and that heralds a change for later on today. In fact, a tail end of an old once hurricane is expected to sweep across the country, bringing some gusty conditions to coastal areas and some rain. That's going to eventually reach Northern Ireland and also western parts of Scotland, as well as the Irish sea coasts later on. Some areas will get the rain as early as lunchtime, but I think the Lake District and Lancashire won't get the rain until the middle of the afternoon. Around coastal areas, it will be very windy, gusts of 40 or even 50 miles an hour in the northwest. Temperatures in the northwest around 15 degrees, but with the bright and drier weather the further east and south you are today, well, up to about 23 degrees Celsius in London, but more typically it'll be around 20. Back to you.
All feeling very autumnal out there. Thank you very much, Thomas. You're listening today on BBC Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Simon Jack. It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 21st of August. The headlines this morning. The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has set out details of her plan to tackle illegal immigration, including more removals flights and the recruitment of 100 investigators to target smuggling gangs. Government borrowing jumped to more than £3 billion last month, the highest July figure for 3 years. Barack and Michelle Obama have given passionate endorsements of Kamala Harris for president in front of an ecstatic Democratic Party convention. And divers are spending a third day searching the wreck of a superyacht off Sicily for the six passengers who are still missing. The BBC News is read by Lisa Costello.
The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has announced new details of the government's plan for a border security command to tackle illegal immigration. 100 new intelligence and investigations officers will be appointed this year to target smuggling gangs. And the government is promising a large surge in returns flights for people here illegally. The Conservatives say that by scrapping the plan to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda, Labour had shown they weren't serious about stopping the boats. More from our political correspondent Harry Farley.
More than 19,000 people have crossed the Channel in small boats so far this year, a 10% increase on last year, but a fall from the peak of more than 21,000 over the same period in 2022. Labour have abandoned the Rwanda policy. Instead, the government says these new specialist officers will increase the work the National Crime Agency is already doing to target gangs smuggling people across the Channel. They will work in the UK and across Europe, with some undercover and others targeting the supply of inflatable boats and equipment. Yvette Cooper is also promising a surge in forcible removals of people who are in the UK illegally. The Home Office has said it will continue with the previous government's plan to reopen two immigration centres near Oxford and Portsmouth, increasing their capacity to detain migrants.
Yvette Cooper is promising to reach the highest rate of removals since Theresa May's premiership 6 years ago. Dr. Peter Walsh, a senior researcher at Oxford University's Migration Observatory, told us that wasn't a very ambitious target.
If we look at enforced removals, last year there were 6,000. In 2018, there were 9,000. So this would require 3,000 more, a 50% increase, which sounds achievable. The other thing to point out is that 2018 is not an especially high bar. Apart from the pandemic, that was the lowest number of enforced removals in 20 years.
Government borrowing rose faster than expected to £3.1 billion last month to cover the gap between public spending and the amount raised by tax. The Office for National Statistics says the figure is £1.8 billion above the same month last year and is the highest July borrowing since 2021. Labour says it shows the dire economic legacy left by the Conservatives. Carl Emerson, the Deputy Director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, told us the increased borrowing was driven by government departments spending more than expected on public services.
What that means is we're a third of the way through the financial year. And if you look at all previous years, the government's always spent below a third of the departmental budgets in the first third of the year. But so far this year, they've already spent 34%. And when you look at government borrowing, that 1% up on spending is actually a big number.
Barack and Michelle Obama have told the Democratic Party convention that Kamala Harris is ready to be the US president and America is ready for her. On the second day of the event in Chicago, the former First Lady said that with Ms. Harris, hope was making a comeback. Mr. Obama attacked the Republican candidate Donald Trump as weird and stale and said the country didn't want another 4 years of what he called Mr. Trump's bluster, bumbling and chaos.
We have seen that movie before, and we all know that the sequel is usually worse. America's ready for a new chapter. America's ready for a better story. We are ready for a President Kamala Harris.
The search operation for six people missing after a luxury yacht sank off the coast of Sicily has entered its third day. The Italian authorities have said divers are struggling to get into the wreck of the Baesian, which went down in a storm on Monday with 22 people on board. Among the missing is the British tech entrepreneur Mike Lynch. The body of the yacht's chef has been recovered. Our correspondent Mark Lowen reports from Sicily.
For a third straight day, the divers will be racing to reach the cabin of the Baesian superyacht, helped by remote-controlled vehicles that can operate on the seabed for far longer than the rescuers themselves. It is no longer survivors that they are trying to find, but bodies of the six missing passengers, probably sleeping inside when the ship was hit by a tornado-like waterspout, which capsized it. Dr. Fabio Genco from the Palermo Emergency Medical Services treated the 15 survivors when they were brought ashore.
The word that all the injured kept repeating was darkness, the darkness that they experienced during the shipwreck. They spoke of about 5 minutes, from the moment the boat was lifted, raised by the waves of the sea, until it sank.
British investigators are here in Sicily working to assess the disaster and whether measures were taken on board to mitigate the extreme weather, like closing hatches. All secrets that the Baesian may have taken down with it to the bottom of the ocean.
The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has said a proposal for a Gaza ceasefire involves a detailed plan for the withdrawal of Israeli troops from the territory. He was responding to reported comments by Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, suggesting he'd persuaded Mr. Blinken that his forces must stay. Our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman, is travelling with Mr. Blinken.
The reported comments by Mr. Netanyahu have angered the US administration, with one senior official suggesting they jeopardize progress towards a ceasefire. The Israeli leader was quoted as saying he had maybe convinced Mr. Blinken that the agreement must see Israeli troops remaining in key parts of Gaza, including along the border with Egypt. The comments came just as the Secretary of State was flying to meet Arab leaders who the Americans want to entice Hamas into accepting an agreement urgently. Mr. Blinken revealed that the agreement involves what he called a detailed schedule for Israeli troop withdrawals from Gaza, but he wouldn't confirm the extent of their pullout. And so this increasingly fraught issue remains a major barrier to reaching a deal.
New data suggests the rising cost of renting has started to cool this year after a period of rapid increases. The figures shared with the BBC by the property portal Zoopla suggest rents for newly let homes are rising at their slowest rate for 3 years. Richard Donnell from the firm explained what's contributed to the change.
We've got reports of fewer student numbers. We've got a slower pace of people coming to the UK to work and to study. So we're seeing localised changes in demand, supply improving through new build and some investors buying property. And in some areas, rents have simply overshot and they need to fall back to sort of a level where people can afford them.
A study suggests that eating just 2 slices of ham a day can raise the risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Scientists at the University of Cambridge also found a heightened risk from as little as 100 grams of unprocessed red meat a day, equivalent to a small steak. The findings have been published in the Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology Journal. More details from Joe Inwood.
By looking at data from nearly 2 million people, this study claims to have found the most concrete evidence yet that too much red meat, especially processed, raises your risk of type 2 diabetes. It found 50 grams of things like ham, bacon or sausages a day made you 15% more likely to develop the disease within the next 10 years. Unprocessed meat had a similar effect. 100 grams of beef, lamb or pork a day raises the risk by 10%. The authors said the study supported healthy eating recommendations to cut down meat intake.
Drones have been used successfully to safely deliver blood products between 2 hospitals in Northumberland. The trial by NHS Blood and Transplant and a medical logistics company examined how to reduce the carbon footprint of getting blood supplies around the country. It found there was no significant difference in quality between the products that travelled by road or air. Rebecca Cardigan from NHS Blood and Transplants told this programme that more steps needed to be taken before drones could be used to blood supplies around the country.
This is the first step in a series of studies where we're going to assess its suitability both for the safety of carrying blood but also some of the logistical challenges regarding the sort of regulatory framework, and we obviously need to do a sort of economic analysis of it in order to be able to implement. But we're absolutely delighted that this first step is really positive and we're looking forward to those further studies.
The BBC broadcaster Lauren Laverne has revealed that she's been diagnosed with cancer. In a post on social media, the Desert Island Discs presenter said it was caught early during a screening test and that she was expected to make a full recovery. The Australian government has approved plans for a massive solar project which could eventually power 3 million homes and export energy. Australia's Environment Minister said the Suncable project in the Northern Territory would make the country a world leader in green energy. Australia is currently a big exporter and consumer of coal.
Lisa, thank you very much, and wishing our Radio 4 colleague Lauren Laverne well as she recovers after that diagnosis. It's 8:10. More people have crossed the channel in small boats so far this year than did in the same period last year. Up to the 19th of August last year, there were close to 17,500 crossings. In the same period this year, it was more than 19,000. There were 827 arrivals in the last 7 days alone. All of this is now Labour's problem, and it will address it, the government says, through policies, including what is being set out today. More investigating officers, more beds at removal centres, and more deportation flights. The Conservatives say scrapping their Rwanda plan shows Labour is not serious about reversing the current picture. That picture is one that Matt Coker sees with his own eyes. He is a fisherman on the Kent coast.
Originally, we'd only see 2 or 3 a day, and now we're seeing probably 5, 6, sometimes 7 boats. They used to be quite small, and there was all different types of boats, and they were just really anything they could get hold of, whereas now they're large, purpose-made inflatables, so they are about 10 metres long, the amount of people on them was anywhere up to about 80. It does seem that there's been, you know, a lot more boats. I mean, something I did find very strange, and we all talked about it, you know, all the fishermen talked about it, was in the sort of first part of this summer, we had some very good weather, and there was only two or three boats coming across every day, which was, we expected to see a lot more than that. But now it's back to business as usual, and there's sort of five, six, seven boats coming across each day, and it makes quite a difference, really, with the numbers they're carrying.
Let's analyse then what the Home Office and the new Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, is setting out today, the measures that they have put out with, in a moment, Danny Shaw, someone who used to advise Yvette Cooper while she was the Shadow Home Secretary, and first Tony Smith, former Director General of the UK Border Force, who advised the Conservative government for a time in Rishi Sunak's time. Good morning, Tony. Welcome back to the programme.
Thank you. Good morning.
So let's start with what we know then from the Home Office, including 100 new intelligence and investigating officers who will work with the National Crime Agency on this issue. A good move?
I wondered whether this was the start of the setting up of the new Border Security Command when I first saw this, but it seems these 100 officers are going to go to the National Crime Agency. There are a number of agencies involved in international organised crime, human smuggling, including the Border Force, Immigration Enforcement and the NCA. So I think, you know, an additional injection of resources into any of our enforcement teams is always going to be welcomed. But the big challenge, of course, here is that most of the criminality is occurring, of course, in northern France or further afield in Europe, and we will need the collaboration of Europol, of the member states and others, European Border Agency, to tackle the gangs, which is their policy. And so I think much depends on how that works and what we can do and what we can't do to do that.
There's been talk in the past, hasn't there, of trying to get the agreement from France that would allow our law enforcement on their beaches, which they've always resisted. Do you think there's any chance of getting anywhere on that, and would it make a difference?
Well, yes, you're right. The previous administration tried very hard to extend our reach, if you like, into northern France. But there are rules and regulations about what we are and are not allowed to do in Europe. So this will be a political initiative in terms of joint ventures that we are able to undertake. There have been some successes, but I mean, this is a hugely lucrative business and the business model has not been broken. Lots of people will still pay lots of money to human smuggling gangs, and if you take one out, then there's probably another one waiting in the wings to take their place. So I think it's very difficult to assume that by putting more officers into the NCA that we're going to crack the problem, but it'll certainly help.
Okay, let's turn to another aspect of this. Again, very much then on this, on these shores, they're promising a large surge in return flights and presumably as part of that, nearly 300 more beds in immigration removal centres.
Yeah, so I mean, the promise is to get removals up to 2018 levels, which were about 25,000 a year. I think last year we did 23,000, so another 2,000 should be achievable. The detention estate, yes, I mean, that actually in my time was at around 4,000 beds. It's down to about 2,300 now, so another 200. Is again a step in the right direction, but you know, to get the removals figures back to where they were maybe when, you know, back in the UKBA days, I think that's going to take quite a lot of effort. And we need to remember that, you know, different countries, it's easier to remove some nationalities than others. So I suspect there will be a focus upon those countries where we do have good relationships, where we are able to secure documents and secure flights, quite easy to return them, from those more difficult nationality cohorts where we don't have those things in place and it's much more difficult to return them. And I think that was what was behind the Rwanda plan, would have been that would have been an outlet for those nationalities that are much harder to remove, which would not have involved a removal back to source country, but a removal to a safe third country. So I think all in all, that probably is deliverable. I think that's a step in the right direction again. But I mean, we'll just have to wait to see, you know, what impact that actually has on, you know, disrupting the gangs and stopping the boats.
Well, because the big numbers do come from the difficult countries, don't they? I'm looking at figures for the year to March 2024. And if I look at the top six countries for numbers of arrivals across the channel, Afghanistan, Iran, Turkey, Eritrea, Syria, Iraq. Now, you can, just mentioning those countries, everyone will be able to see the problems with returning people there. Probably Turkey is the only one where you could have a decent chance of return. But even then, if you're a Kurd facing prosecution, you could probably successfully argue against it.
Yes, so you're right. Although those are the difficult, apart from Turkey, those are the top five most difficult countries to remove people to. But, the cohorts do change quite a bit. And we have seen other nationalities, Vietnamese, for example, as you say, Turkey, Pakistan, India. These are countries that we can remove people to, that we do have arrangements with, that we have had charter flights to some of them to send people back. So if you're talking about volume, sheer volume, and getting another 2,000, I think by focusing upon those nationalities, you may achieve your desired outcome. But I'm not sure where we are on removals targets these days. We had removals targets in the Home Office when I was there, and I had myself a target of a volume removals to deliver. I'm not sure that's there anymore. So I think there will be some changes in the way that the Home Office is structured to identify where these removals are going to come from and how they're going to restructure the department to deliver them.
Tony Smith, thank you very much. And let me turn then to Danny Shaw, former advisor to Yvette Cooper. This ambition on the increase in removal flights, Danny, getting back to 2018 levels is an increase of somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 from where we are now. It's not a big ambition, is it?
No, it's a very modest ambition, and it's slightly unclear whether this is a 12-month target or a 6-month target, if it's enforced or voluntary. But whatever the exact target is, it's a fairly modest ambition. I'm sure it's achievable. But this really does mark a difference with the previous government, which sort of set up, ridiculous schemes and ideas that were never going to happen. What we're seeing from Yvette Cooper is something that is more practical, is grounded in reality. And even though the steps are small, they're certainly going in the right direction, because removals is a vital part of the asylum and immigration system. You have to have a fully functioning system where people who have no right to stay in the UK are removed. The levels were around 40,000, 45,000 not so long ago, I think in around 2012. So it's perfectly possible to get back to those levels, and starting with this modest target is certainly the right step.
But how do you do it? You need those, wouldn't you need some kind of returns agreement with the countries from which the large numbers come? And it's not going to happen with Afghanistan or with Iran or with Iraq or with Syria.
Well, the first thing you have to do is start processing claims from people. And the Conservative government has stopped doing that and have built up a backlog of well over 100,000 people who hadn't even had an initial decision on their asylum claim. So once you start processing cases, then you start making decisions about whether people can stay in the UK or not. And if you decide they have no right to be in the UK, then you can start removing them. So that process had basically stopped. The second thing you have to do is to resource the returns department. And I think there are steps in that direction. We're told that there's some 300 caseworkers who have already been reassigned to do returns. And there are, I think, plans that have been drawn up to increase that number. And then the other thing you have to do is to start drawing up agreements with countries where it's been difficult to return people. There's a lot of diplomacy efforts that need to be undertaken to do that. And that's the way that you ramp up these numbers.
Yeah,
it's not an easy thing you can do in one go, but it requires an effort over a number of years.
Yes, but I still wonder, looking at the scale of the numbers there, and so, we're now more than 19,000 this year alone. You've got hundreds of people in a summer period like this coming over every week. Do you think Labour is going to be able to stop the boats?
I think it's certainly possible to get the numbers down, Michelle, but it's going to take many months and possibly years to do it, and it's going to take action on a number of fronts. Increasing removals is one way of doing that because it sends out an important deterrent message. Another way is to get the asylum system functioning properly, so that people don't have to wait an average of 20 months for their claim to be processed, which is the case at the moment. The other thing you have to do is to start developing more safe routes. You have to increase resources to the National Crime Agency and other intelligence services in order to try and get the smuggling gangs and to stop them further upstream. And the final piece in the jigsaw, and this is my own view, is you have to seek some kind of agreement with the French or with the EU so that people who come here illegally are immediately sent back on a ferry to France. That is really the sort of the vital bit in all this. And that'll take a lot of negotiation and agreement with the EU and with France, which I'm sure that kind of work might be starting already.
Danny Shaw, thank you very much.
Now, it's 21 minutes past eight. The cult video game series Civilization is back following an eight-year hiatus. It's a strategy game where you take a nation from ancient times through centuries of development, putting down cities, fighting wars. And the newest version of the game will be set in Londinium, or London, in the Roman era. It takes it from there up until now. Mike Pitts is a writer and archaeologist and can tell us the real story. But Tom Gherkin is BBC technology reporter who's been playing Civilization since it was first released in the 90s. And I have to say, Tom, I didn't play it, but I remember going into the computer room at university and seeing people who'd been up all night, ashtrays overflowing back in those days, empty cans of lager about people who'd been playing for hours. What's the great attraction?
Yeah, well, one of my more amusing childhood memories is seeing my brother playing that game at about 9 o'clock when I went to bed, waking up in the middle of the night at 5 a.m. and seeing him still playing it. That was from the PlayStation back in the 90s. Yeah, this game is addictive to people. It's one more turn mentality is what people say. Imagine like a board game, you're playing it, you think, oh, well, I'll just wait for my next turn so I can do the next thing. Oh, I'll just wait for my next turn and do the next thing. By the time the next turn has come and gone, the next turn is about to come and go.
Yeah, and what is the tactics here? I mean, does aggression pay off when it comes to building a civilization? Is war the answer? Are there a lot of peace summits that go on in this game?
What's so good about the Civilization series is it inspires lots of different forms of play. You know, one civilization might be particularly good at war, the sort of civilizations of history that you might associate with war, but other civilizations might be particularly good at peace. Sweden, if you're playing as Sweden, for example, you might expect to be much more peaceful than if you were playing as the ancient Zulus.
Mm. And what's and the new edition, London in the Roman era, to taking that through to the present day, does that excite you?
It's so exciting because historically this game has been pick one civilization, the same leader, you'll be Robert the Bruce in Scotland, for example, and that's you for the entire game. Now they've gone, well, hang on a second, that's not how civs actually worked in real life. Londinium was the ancient Romans, and then 1,000 years later, the Normans have been there, the Vikings have been there, it's all changed, and under the Tudors, it looks completely different than it did then. And then you jump back even further in the future, by the time you're at the Victorian era, it's completely different once again. So you're building on top of what came before now, okay, not just what was already there. Well, and that's really exciting.
Your enthusiasm for this shines through there, Tom. I think I can see you spending a number of hours there. Let's talk to Mike Pitts about the real version of London from its Roman era and up until now. I'm taking it, I don't know if you've played this game, Mike, but if you were building a Roman London, what key things would you start with?
Morning, Simon. Morning. I have never played a computer game in my life, so...
Maybe you can start.
Yes, I'd need some fairly basic instructions, I think. Roman London was a great city. It was the biggest in Britain by far, but also a significant point in the Roman Empire. And I think we need to think of it really as much as we think of any great city, indeed as we think of London today, as a cosmopolitan centre with people from all over the empire speaking different languages and looking differently and bringing different interests, business, residential, religious, military and so on. There are a mix of corporate official buildings, temples, forum, bath suites, there's a fort, a big Roman fort in the corner of the city. The city itself is surrounded by massive walls. The parts of London, you can still see those walls. If you imagine today, it's quite a small city in modern terms. I mean, it reached between the Tower of London and just beyond St. Paul's. Okay. And it's got a river going through the middle, Walbrook. It's a busy industrial residential mix.
And would it have been particularly well organised? You talk about, would it have had refuse areas, water carrying facilities? Would it work like a civic authority? Would it have such some sort of organisation?
Yes, Romans were famously bureaucratic. I mean, there are cemeteries, for example, an important part of the city, to the north and the west and the east of the city outside the walls. There's a grid of streets, a fair bit of which you can see in the modern city still today, that's well maintained. And there are dumps of refuse. There are areas that are constantly being rebuilt. And there's a military presence, so that has some effect on the way the city is administered. And south of the river, there's a bridge across the Thames, and at this time, the Thames is much wider than it is today and had quite a lot of marshy and sort of little islands and things scattered around it. And across the bridge to the south, you get into what is now Southwark, and there was a sort of less controlled, if you like, area of Roman London expanding south of the river.
Mm. It sounds, it might have been better organised back then than it is now, potentially. I don't know if Tom is still there. I mean, do you have a lot of leeway in how the civilization develops? I mean, presumably you could end up from a Roman-era London to something which doesn't resemble what we have today at all.
Absolutely. I mean, you have complete, it's a sandbox kind of game. You'll choose where to place your district, building out from the middle of a city. You might place a granary down here and a cistern beside it, and then grow on top of that. It'll just completely change as the game goes. It's so funny listening to you, I've a guest there, looking at the way London develops through the eras, because he mentioned this sort of religious area in Londinium. And if you look in the way it developed and going through into the future in real life, you'll see that this religious area remained a religious area. And that's where you ended up with lots of temples at the time. And then going forward, other big religious buildings like churches. And now that same religious area has St. Paul's Cathedral. So it's cool how throughout history, some parts stay the same. Other parts, like the Ludgate part of the wall, well, that's not there anymore.
OK, well, art imitating reality or the other way around. I can't quite work out which is which there. But Mike Pitts, writer and archaeologist, and Tom Gherkin, BBC technology reporter and clear civilization enthusiast. Thank you very much indeed.
Convinced, Simon?
I don't know. I think I'm just too old to get into video games now. I think that window is mercifully shut.
Really? Maybe to pass a bit of time somewhere. Anyway, Mike Williams with the sport.
Thank you, Michelle. England's men will continue a truncated summer of Test cricket later this morning when their three-match series with Sri Lanka gets underway at Old Trafford. The main headlines heading into this have surrounded Ollie Pope, who will captain England for the first time later, the vice-captain stepping up to deputise for the injured Ben Stokes. Well, delighted to say that we can speak to the former England captain, Sir Alistair Cook, who joins us live on the programme. Morning, Alistair.
Good morning.
Many thanks for your time. So, a word on Pope. A very proud day for him and his family, of course. But I just wonder, how do team dynamics work when it comes to stand-in captains? Do players and the skipper themselves behave differently when they know that this is just a temporary arrangement?
Well, that's a great question. There's not many times where England have needed a stand-in captain. I think after the last 170 Test match, only one game, I think Joe Root, he missed a game for the birth of his second child, but otherwise the captain has been fit and available for a long period of time. It's a strange situation in one sense. I took over actually before I became permanent captain against Bangladesh for two games, when Andrew Strauss took that tour off. And there's a little bit of uncertainty because you know, when there's a familiar thing when Strauss was captain and decisions all went through, and when a new guy comes on, it is a little bit unfamiliar. But because you're not changing the team dynamic, Ollie Pope won't be thinking about changing how Ben Stokes sets up this side. So it's just about on the field. So it'd be slightly unusual for the players. But remember, these players are very experienced and also have played under a lot of different captains this year already in other formats. So, you know, I don't think it'll change much of the side. It's a great day for Ollie Pope and one which he'll never forget.
And important to say as well that Ben Stokes is still on the scene, isn't he? He's staying with the team at Old Trafford. He's been advising on selection. The promise is not to be a backseat driver, but if Ollie Pope is to be the heir to Ben Stokes eventually, do you think that Pope will welcome Stokes' continued involvement? Or perhaps secretly, do you think he might wish he could have a clear run at being captain?
Well, it is a stopgap. So it's three games. I think Ollie Pope knows that. The whole team knows that. That as soon as Ben Stokes is fit after his hamstring, he will be back in there. So I don't see any issue with Ben Stokes being around. You know, when the team and the 11 players take the outfield, it's Ollie Pope making decisions. Like, not very many times is, you know, the off-field influence from messages really does much, really. Occasionally you get the odd idea, but, you know, he's been given the captaincy, he's been vice captain, so everyone knew that this could be a scenario, especially with Ben Stokes, an all-rounder, you know, likely to pick up more injuries than, say, just a batter. So they're prepared for it. I don't think it'll change a little bit, change too much. And having Ben Stokes there, I think that should be more of a blanket of comfort volley poke than anything else.
And just a final word, Alistair, on England's opponents, Sri Lanka. On paper, do you think that they should give England a tougher test than the West Indies did earlier this summer?
Well, I don't know, to be honest with you. You know, I expect England to win and win well. The Sri Lankans are a very competitive unit, though. And whatever team I've ever played against, they always seem to punch above the weight. And I know it's a different format, but they beat India in the last one-day series. So these guys are talented. I just feel as if English conditions, and apart from a couple of major players, you know, Sri Lanka, Angelo Matthews, Shanwell, there's not a huge amount of experience in English conditions. And unfortunately, that is so vital, you know, certainly in Test match cricket.
Yeah, Matthew Potts, the other big player, having a big day today, making his debut. Dan Lawrence opening the batting in place of the injured Zach Crawley. Looking forward to the start of this Test series. Alistair Cook, many thanks for your time this morning. Alistair, part, of course, of the Test match special team that will bring you ball by ball commentary from every day of this Test series, starting this morning on 5 Live Sports Extra from 10:25. Finally, just time to tell you that the tips are back. If you haven't heard, one of the last major race meetings of the flat season gets underway this afternoon, York's Ebor Festival. So we have two selections for you from there. The first at 2:25, number 11, Yarrug, and then at 3:35, again, number 11, Calandagan.
Thanks very much, Mike. Here's what's coming up later this morning.
What would you do if you went to work at sea thousands of miles away and the Home Office said you'd been trafficked? What if you'd paid an agency so much money that there was no going back, even though you thought the conditions on board were terrible? You'd seek justice, wouldn't you? But how? I've been meeting the fishermen from across the world who've been trying to do just that here in the UK. A BBC investigation almost 3 years in the making. That's File on 4, Invisible Souls, with me, Monica Whitlock, this morning at 11.
The weather, it'll be cloudy today across the north with outbreaks of rain. They'll turn heavy and persistent across the west of Scotland.
You're listening today on Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain, Simon Jack, at 27 minutes to 9. Lisa Costello has a summary of the news.
The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has revealed more details of the government's plan to tackle illegal immigration. It includes appointing 100 new intelligence and investigations officers to target smuggling gangs and a surge in returns flights for people living here illegally. A former Director General of the UK Border Force, Tony Smith, told this programme that collaboration with European countries was key to tackling the problem. Government borrowing rose more than expected to £3.1 billion last month. The Office for National Statistics says the figure is £1.8 billion above the total for the same month last year and is the highest July borrowing since 2021. The search operation for six people missing after a luxury yacht sank off the coast of Sicily has entered its third day. Among the missing is the British tech entrepreneur Mike Lynch. Barack and Michelle Obama have delivered passionate endorsements of Kamala Harris on the second day of the US Democratic Party convention, saying America was ready for a new chapter with her as president.
Thanks, Lisa. The Mpox outbreak, which centres in and around the Democratic Republic of Congo, has already seen 16,000 cases recorded and nearly 600 deaths. The World Health Organization has already declared it an emergency. And yesterday, Africa's main public health agency announced plans to make 10 million vaccines, largely manufactured in Europe, available across the continent. Well, earlier, I asked Dr. Hans Kluge, the regional director for Europe of the WHO, if the call for vaccines had come a little late.
I think it highlights the underlying key challenge, namely the one of global solidarity. If I look from a WHO European perspective, there are two things. Mpox is not the new COVID. We know how to control it, but we need to stand in solidarity with Africa while in the European region, we need to go for elimination.
What you're saying is it doesn't present a direct threat to Europe in the way that COVID did, but nevertheless, we need a globally coordinated response to outbreaks like this.
Absolutely. In Europe, we're dealing mainly with clade 2, which is being transmitted particularly in men having sex with men. But we always say no one is safe until everyone is safe. So we have to be vigilant. The risk in general to the population is low, so there is no need for panic. People are asking Do we have to go in lockdown on this? Absolutely not. But we have to share all information between countries and keep ourselves sharp.
The main manufacturer of the vaccine, a company called Bavarian Nordic, has said it needs to make a call on whether to manufacture what they say at risk. That means manufacture this stuff without signed contracts, without someone saying they actually want to buy the stuff. Because switching manufacturing capacity from other vaccines to this takes time to ramp up. What is wrong? Is there something wrong with the process here?
The Bavarian Nordic could already supply up to 2 million doses by the end of 2024 and 10 million vaccine doses by the end of 2025. And we have two more vaccines. But again, it underscores the whole issue of equity, which was the big lesson learned from the COVID-19. You see that when it becomes a hot potato in the European region, all the alarm bells are going on. But when it is in a population which is in, let's say, resource poor countries, it's a different ballgame.
What did we learn from COVID? I mean, do we feel as a planet a more connected community when it comes to dealing with these kind of issues?
This is the big test case now. Are we going to help the African region or not? Because for now, it's a relatively comfortable situation. We have only one case of clade 1 in Sweden, so it's more easy to share the vaccines. What would happen if there are more and more cases? Are the European countries going to hoard the vaccines again or not? Now, let's be a little bit optimistic. We see that, for example, the European Commission Health Emergency Authority already is sharing vaccines, a number of countries as well, but we will have to see how this develops. The good news is that WHO has declared the mpox for a second time in 2 years, a public health emergency of international concern, very swiftly, and the African CDC was even a step before. Mm. So the alert has been out there much faster than before. Mm.
So are you saying that the lesson we learned is that rather than hoarding vaccines, you should direct them to the source of the outbreak? That is the best way to deal with this, rather than wait till it comes to your shores and store the vaccines for your own population?
Absolutely, because we're living in an interconnected world. We're not going to be able to stop travel and exchange. So the whole world has become a small village. I was speaking actually to the Director General of the African CDC, Dr. Jean Kaseya, yesterday, and he mentioned three concerns. One is the vaccine hoarding. Second is to advocate against any travel bans to the African countries, which links to the third point, the stigma and discrimination. Because this, the clade 2 is in men having sex with men. So we really have to avoid the stigma and discrimination, because otherwise we impact negatively on health-seeking behavior. And let's not forget that countries like Portugal in 2022 managed to control the mpox even before the vaccines application, based on empowering trusted messengers in high-risk communities. So we have to engage with the high-risk communities, which means in Europe, first and foremost, with men having sex with men.
Dr. Hans Kluge, thank you very much indeed.
It is 20 to 9. More parents of nine-month-olds in England should from next month be able to access 15 hours of free childcare a week. There are eligibility criteria around earnings. Those were set out by the last government when they announced the policy, which is part of a full rollout, which is supposed to give all eligible parents of under fives 30 free hours a week by next September. The Education Secretary has said she's working flat out with local leaders to deliver the places, but there are enormous gaps, she says, left behind by the Tories. Neil Leach is Chief Executive of the Early Years Alliance, which represents thousands of nurseries, childminders and preschools, and also runs some of its own childcare settings. Morning to you, Neil.
Good morning.
So how easy is it going to be for parents who've heard about this entitlement and want to access the 15 free hours to find it?
The reality is it won't be easy. And when you have, dare I say, the Secretary of State, Bridget Phillipson, acknowledging that this is a major challenge, that parents will not necessarily get the offers that they have previously been promised, I think that's the starting point. And I have to say, representing 14,000 members ourselves, they are telling us that they are unable to deliver these new offers on the basis that they were basically sold. So it is a major, major problem at this particular point in time. And it will get worse because, of course, all of these offers will double double in September of 25.
As we get to the point of the full rollout, but just explain, parents won't find it easy to access it. Will they, if you're the parent of an eligible 9-month-old, will you get offered something?
You may well be offered something. At this particular point in time, the figures show that around what we call the codes, the eligibility codes basically being allocated, around 85% have gone through. But that doesn't mean that you will necessarily get the hours that you want, the days that you want, and in the location that you want. I mean, you know, we're talking to parents and they're telling us they're travelling miles and miles to find a place. We're talking to parents who are saying, you know, we've knocked on the doors of a nursery or a preschool and they have a waiting list until 2026. So what I think parents felt they would get will not necessarily, frankly, be the case.
Why won't it happen?
Because we don't have enough staff, frankly. We don't have enough educators. I think it's important to realise that when this offer was rolled out by or proposed by the previous government, it was announced, first of all, without a single word of consultation with the sector. And you would think that if it was the biggest investment that the government had made, that they would at least talk to the people that were responsible for delivering it. If you did this in any other walk of business, if you announced your biggest product ever and you hadn't talked to your marketing or your finance director or your retail outlets, frankly, you'd be sacked. But somehow it was good enough for the early years. So, A, no consultation. B, it was against a backdrop of record closures that we hadn't witnessed before. And I would say this, is that C, we have a recruitment and retention crisis that, again, we have never witnessed. And at this point in time, we're struggling to cope with the existing offers, never mind the new ones.
But that's because the sector doesn't pay enough, is it?
The sector doesn't pay enough. I mean,
Are these private providers?
It's a spread. It's private, voluntary, independent. We're a voluntary organisation. We operate 41 settings exclusively in areas of deprivation. This time, 5 years ago, we operated 132. We've had to close the vast majority of those because of financial sustainability. So it isn't just the fact that, you know, I wouldn't want you to think that private providers are making shed loads of money. That is not the case. This time, 4 weeks ago, I was in front of the Low Pay Commission to try and explain why it was that our educators are paid such a low salary. The reality is, if you don't invest enough, if you don't value these people as being part of the education system, and we've had a decade of neglect, then we can't afford to pay more money. We wouldn't have closed those nurseries had there been enough funding in the system.
Neil Leach, Chief Executive of Early Years Alliance, thank you.
17 minutes to nine. A major duathlon, that's a bike ride followed by a run, has been cancelled due to safety concerns. It was due to be held in Richmond Park, but it's been cancelled due to fears that speeding cyclists could present a safety threat to other park users. Now, back in May, Hilda Griffiths, an 81-year-old retired teacher, died after being hit by a cyclist, was one of a group doing time lapse to an app around Regent's Park. So a short while ago, I spoke to her son, Jared Griffiths, and asked if he approved of the decision to cancel the event.
Obviously, my mum's tragic collision was, you know, like a matter of pain and suffering. So anything that can be preventing those similar circumstances happening again in the Royal Parks, being a public place, I believe, you know, like measures should be put in place to prevent as much as possible.
Mm. The group of cyclists, one of whom struck your mother, they were competing against each other on an app. It wasn't an organised event. This would have been more organised. Is there a place, basically, for bicycles, cycling races to happen in public places at all, in your view?
Well, you know, like, on public roads, as long as they're stewarded, marshalled, you know, maybe the roads are closed off, but not, I don't know, Richmond Park specifically, but I presume it's an open space for everyone. So it shouldn't impact everybody, you know, like who uses the park, like park runs, you know, like they'll allocate a certain space of the park to run in and then that will be used and it doesn't impact everybody. My mum's case was it's the outer circle of Regent's Park, which is a road open to the public.
And it's a perfect circle, so it kind of lends itself to this. I think the Royal Parks have asked the app makers, a lot of people sort of compete on this app, to take certain routes off that app in order to sort of protect pedestrian safety. Presumably that's, I mean, is that, are there been enough countermeasures being made in your view to protect public safety from speeding cyclists?
I think the main part of it is about people's behaviour and accountability. If you're in an area where pedestrians and are going to be around, then you have to be more aware of your surroundings and not just in the zone of my time, my lap, whatever, you know, like, is more important. And I believe that will be, you know, if a law was updated to make there more sort of powers for the police to prosecute when tragedies like my mum's happen, then that would be in the back of people's minds. Mm.
Do you think that there's a sort of disparity in the law that cyclists have a sort of special dispensation, for example, a 20-mile-an-hour speed limit, and there's a sort of different mindset?
Yeah, I believe that my mum's case highlighted it in the inquest, in the coroner's inquest, that people weren't aware of there being no upper speed limit for cyclists. And I've never yet seen a speed limit sign where it says 20 miles an hour, except for cyclists. You know, it's always people presumed it's for everyone. And if there is that disparity, I believe that there should be something brought in line that if you have a collision and you found that you're going over the speed limit for the road you're on by a data app or a tracking device, then that can be used as well.
Mm. But on the other hand, you know, cycling's incredibly popular and got more popular over the years. It can be well organised. We can't control how people spend their pastimes if that's what they want to do.
Oh, no, of course, but it's about, as I say, it's about having respect for everyone and for others. You know, like, at the end of the day, everyone's a pedestrian, regardless of whether you're on a bike or in a car. You're a pedestrian at some point during the day. And I believe that you've got to be more aware of what's around you. Obviously, cars speed, you see that. People go through red lights. But when things happen in regards of tragedies and collisions, there has to be some more accountability on behalf of cyclists as well.
And actually, sometimes the new electric bikes can accelerate faster than some people are used to. That can cause judgment difficulties. If you're trying to work out whether you can get across the road before an electric bike comes, their acceleration can be quite hard to predict.
Well, that's it. And I mean, they're capped at 15.5 miles per hour, I believe, the official ones, but people obviously got to them. And they can be on you in seconds, in the same way as like the group my mum came across. They were travelling between 11 and 13 metres per second. So in a distance, they look like a dot. Okay. And then all of a sudden, they're on you.
Ian Duncan-Smith had proposed an amendment to the Criminal Justice Bill that would have seen causing death or serious injury by careless or dangerous cycling become an offence, with up to 14-year prison sentences. In the wash on the election, it looks to have been lost slightly in that process. Would you like to see Labour take that up?
Well, yes, we countersigned a letter to both Labour and Conservative on behalf of bereaved families of cycling collisions. And both Labour and Conservative, whoever got in, said they would take it up. And I do believe, I have it on good authority, that Sir Ian Duncan-Smith was contacted by the Department for Transport, and they're penciling in a meeting in due course, hopefully. So with a bit of luck, we'll get some sort of traction and maybe some change.
Okay. Gerard Griffiths, thank you for talking to us this morning. It is 11 minutes to 9. The rising cost of public services and benefits has caused government borrowing to rise by more than expected in July. Official figures out this morning show borrowing, that's the amount more that the government spends more than it gets in, hit $3.1 billion last month. That is the highest level for July since 2021. Speaking earlier on this programme, Carl Emerson, Deputy Director at the Institute of Fiscal Studies, said the numbers were disappointing.
We're a third of the way through the financial year, and if you look at all previous years, the government's always spent below a third of the departmental budgets in the first third of the year, but so far this year they've already spent 34%, and when you look at government borrowing, that 1% up on spending is actually a big number.
Well, what does all that mean for Rachel Reeves as she gets her budget together in October? Cara Pacitti is senior economist at the Resolution Foundation. And Cara, first of all, this is a bit of a surprise because the economy has been doing better than forecast. So you'd expect tax receipts to go up, and they have been. But the benefits and pensions and public services bill is rising faster. Is that what's happening?
Yep, so tax receipts have been kind of, I guess, largely in line with what the OBR are forecasting to be, slightly below what we'd expect, which, as you said, is in itself unexpected, because actually a lot of things that would normally increase the tax the government gets in, so stronger than expected, growth in the economy, higher inflation than expected, have kind of materialised. What's really driving these really high borrowing figures this month and for this year so far is higher than expected government spending, and that's mainly on sort of departmental spending on on buying things that government departments need and also paying staff, which is perhaps unexpected given we saw those welcome kind of pay increases for public sector workers announced earlier this month.
And what is it, just really breaking this down, is it that it's departmental spending which wasn't allocated properly, as Rachel Reeves was talking about, or is there an element here of inflation-linked benefits and other payments are still have been going up faster than were predicted?
So this is mainly the sort of government's sort of departmental spending on sort of goods and services and things. So not actually kind of benefit spending that we're talking about here. And yeah, it's a public sector pay is definitely a big part of this as well. We saw those kind of pay agreements coming through, and we're starting to see those pressures on government spending and coming through into the data.
So what does this pose? What problems does this pose for Rachel Reeves? What does she need to balance come October the 30th when the budget arrives?
Well, I think the key thing to say is that coming into the budget, it's likely that this year will look much more expensive than the OBR expected when it did its last forecast back in March. What really matters for the government when it's deciding its spending and tax plans is actually more the sort of medium-term horizon, so looking kind of 5 years out, and that's when its sort of fiscal targets actually bind the government. So it wants to have debt falling in 5 years' time. So what actually matters is kind of how far are these costs we're seeing today. How far do they continue into the future? It probably will still be a tough picture for the government at that kind of 5 years looking ahead. So she'll have some real tough questions about whether she tries to kind of cut other spending. Obviously really challenging given they want to boost growth and, you know, spend on investment to get that to happen. Whether they want to raise taxes, that's difficult because taxes are at record levels.
Right.
Or whether they want to borrow more, and obviously that might mean changing their kind of fiscal targets and not getting debt to fall.
And what does the Resolution Foundation, lastly, think about the round of pay increases that we're seeing at the moment? We've seen 22% over 2 years for junior doctors, 15% over 3 years for rail drivers, and a lot of other unions thinking about trying to unpick some of the existing agreements because they say that, you know, everyone's getting a bit more and we would like some of the same. What do you observe about that trend?
So some welcome pay increases for public sector workers. We know that public sector and private sector kind of pay trends have diverged. Seeing a lot of public sector workers seeing kind of real pay cuts over the kind of past few years. We've seen high inflation and also kind of problems with retention in the public sector as a result. Lots of vacancies because the private sector is just kind of that much more well paying. So welcome to see some increases in public sector pay awards, but obviously those do come at a cost, and we're seeing the kind of fiscal and public sector finances pressures that those cause today in the data.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Adi Karapachiti there from the Resolution Foundation.
It is 7 minutes to 9. To love them is to let them go. But parents of teenagers will know the dilemmas about what feels safe and appropriate to you or to them at different stages and how disapproving others can be of your choices. At least that's what presenter Kirsty Allsop discovered when she revealed on social media that she'd allowed her 15-year-old son to go interrailing this summer, accompanied only by another teenager, a 16-year-old. And she joins us now. Morning, Kirsty.
Morning, Michelle.
Now, you had a mix of reactions. Tell me, first of all, whether you struggled with it at all, with this decision to let a 15 and a 16-year-old go away together.
Well, he's 16 today, and he's a summer-born he's a summer-born child, so very young for his year. And as any parent of a summer-born knows, there's always this dilemma that their friends will turn key ages before them, and do you hold them back simply because of the number of days in a year, or do you say yes, you can do what your cohort is doing? So I think that's the first thing. It's strange to say I didn't struggle with it on a practical level, because he came to me with the proposal. He's a very sensible young man. He's never been in trouble at school, and so when he said, I want to do this, I thought, right, okay, good on you. I struggled on an emotional level that I knew I'd be not seeing him for quite a lot of this summer. And, you know, he's only got 2 more years at school, and then he'll probably go to university, and then he'll be away. So as a parent, it's always that thing of, oh, I want to be with my child. Or is it good for them to do their own thing?
This made me think about evaluating risk of different kinds and what I would have done in your position. But And whether, and statisticians could probably tell us the answer to that, but it did make me wonder, is it any safer to, when you compare it to things like getting into a car with a newly qualified driver, which many teenagers will be doing, or going to a music festival where somewhere that drugs are known to circulate and indeed where young people have died?
Oh, Michelle, you have put your... You've put your finger right on it. Those are my worries. Cars and drugs are the things I worry about. Travel is not something that I worry about. I think every parent does worry about different things. And you're absolutely spot on. I'm a pragmatist, and I'm someone who's very, very into statistics. I was very influenced by a book called Factfulness by Hans Rosling. And that talks about the fact that the world is not a worse place. It's actually a better place. And a lot of us think that the world has got worse and that things are more dangerous. And actually, they're not. So
hang on, can I test that though, Kirsty? So have you said no getting into a car with a newly qualified driver and no going to the music festival
is notorious? My other son went to a festival twice. He went the first time and loved it. And then he went a second time with a broken arm. And that's one of the things that I always bear in mind, that my children have had numerous breaks. We average about one a year, terrifyingly. Skiing on bicycles. One of my children was on a school French trip and just jumped off a small wall and broke his wrist. And, you know, children do all sorts of things, often right in front of you. Just when you're watching them, they can fall down and do something. There's no actual guarantee that because you are there, they are safer.
Kirsty, it's Simon here. I'm just wondering, I've got two daughters. Had there been a 15-year-old girl, would you have said the same thing?
Simon, that's very interesting you ask that. A lot of people have asked me that. My parents treated me and my brother exactly the same in that respect. I was allowed an enormous amount of freedom because, as you can probably imagine, I was awfully sensible. And they never thought that I was going to do something that stupid. My brother, on the other hand, bless him, was less sensible, although now he's a very sensible and devoted and caring parent, probably much more of a nervous parent than I am, actually. And so I would have been exactly the same with a girl if I had a girl than with a boy. Obviously, girls face different dangers, but statistically, actually, boys are more at danger from violent attacks by strangers. The dangers that girls can come across, as we all know, are often from people they know.
Did you track him all the way, Kirsty? Were you watching where his phone was?
I didn't track him, but the mother of his... I've never tracked any of my children on their telephones, but the mother of the other boy does track him, and we did have a conversation about it.
That's very useful. Sorry, she told you where they were.
Yes, and obviously we're in touch. And that's another thing, that mobile phones make a huge difference. That's another reason that it's safer today. And health is better. Communication is better. All of the things that weren't available to me when I travelled as a young person are available. And I always have to remember that my father-in-law joined the Arctic convoys when he was 16. My mother-in-law went to university in South Africa when she was 15. My dad joined the army when he was 17. You know, in previous generations, people did things far younger.
And we are sometimes nostalgic about that without being willing to let our children do anything comparable.
Exactly. And I think it's very important. We are looking at a mental health crisis with young people. There are a lot of people talking about it and writing about it. And we have